This episode, Justice League America number 54 and Justice League Europe number 30, cover dated September 1991. Breakdowns, part 3 and 4. Hello, and welcome to the 54th episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irritable Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not flying solo, folks. Every single episode, we feature two different guest hosts, and we'll chat with my second co-host a little bit later. But for now, my first co-host, well, my first co-host, I do not envy them. They are under a lot of pressure here. So not only is this their first time recording a podcast ever, but they are also the spouse of one of the all-time fan favorite guests on this podcast. Let me tell you, they have got some big shoes to fill. Or at the very least, he's got some very stylish high heels to fill. Folks, please help me welcome the husband of Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine. That's right, it's Mr. Tim Levine. Welcome to the New York Embassy, Tim. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Good. How you doing? And congratulations on yet another spousal nepotism hire here, Shag.
You know, it makes it easier, you know, when one brings the other. So thank you. This is my third spousal nepotism hire, so I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, I should say I'm happy to be the Sue Dibney of the podcast, although that's probably not very fair to Sue, and things didn't end up working out that well for her either.
Ouch.
So, yeah.
Wow. I was going to say Sue's so popular, you're really more like the Ralph, because I mean, I think most people would vote Sue and the team, but then you took it to a really dark place.
Well, blame Brad Meltzer.
Well, so let me ask you here. You know, obviously, Dr. Jenny, your wife, has brought some amazing insight into feminism and the way the comics are structured and just the ideas behind them. Are you bringing like a full plate of interestingness, or are you just kind of a little something on the side?
I got none of that. No. Seriously, to try to maybe support my credentials here, I have been reading comics as a Wednesday warrior for almost 35 years.
Okay.
I'd like to think I know a little bit about this and maybe can string a couple ideas together that might be interesting, but you know, your audience is really going to be the judge. I'm not the one to be the judge. So, you know, maybe they'll say, don't ever have that guy back again. We'll see.
Think about it this way, folks. As you begin to write your comments to just tear down Tim here, remember, look at your own spouse and go, oh yeah, she really is my better half. So, okay, I don't need to go after Tim in that same respect. So I know certainly I would never want to follow in the footsteps of my wife. That's for sure.
Well, there you go.
Now, rather than sit here and gush about how amazing Tim's wife is and just give him some sort of inferiority complex, we should get to thanking our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, every episode, we select a collected edition to discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually, it's tied into this month's JLI episode in some way, shape, or form, or maybe I'm really, really, really stretching it with mine just because I want to talk about the Sandman Mystery Theater Compendium. Oh my goodness. My stretching here is that one of the writers on the Sandman Mystery Theater Compendium is Steven Siegel, who also wrote Primal Force, which featured Jack-O-Lantern.
That was such a good series back in the day, too.
It really, really was.
If anyone from DC is listening, collect that.
Yes. It's not the first time we've asked for that on the show, by the way. So DC, chop, chop. But I am going to talk about the Sandman Mystery Theater Compendium Trade Paperback Volume 1. So this collects Sandman Mystery Theater 1 through 36 and the annual. And folks, if you've never read this book, it is fantastic. We're talking, you and I off the air, we were talking about noir stuff. This is hate crimes and noir stuff. It's all about Wesley Dodds, the Sandman in the 1940s, solving dark, gritty, really edgy stuff. Matt Wagner is just top of his game. Steven Siegel writing that. Art by Guy Davis. You've got great photographed covers. The cover on this one's by Gavin Wilson. It is 984 pages. You could, you know, keep a couple of heavy vault doors open with this thing, man.
It is pretty thick. It is pretty thick.
984 pages. It is full color. It's a soft cover. Normally goes for $59.99, but you can get it for 42% off right now. So it's only $34.79. $34.79 for 984 pages of Sandman Mystery Theater is a heck of a steal.
And I will tell you, Shag, that completely independent of you doing this on the podcast, I do have have a copy of that. And
really?
I, in fact, did get it from InStock Trades, believe it or not. So it is thick. It does something that actually I have never seen before. It is so thick that when they do the table of contents at the beginning, they don't even list individual issues. They just list story arcs, I've never seen them do before. I've never read Sandman Mystery Theater, but it's always something I've had on the back of my mind that I wanted to. So I, you know, good deal, and I picked it up.
You're going to love it. It is so phenomenal. It was one of my favorite books when it was coming out. But now, Tim, it's your turn. Did you happen to bring an InStock Trades pick?
Yes, I do. In fact, I have two, if you don't mind.
But I don't think I can stop you. So.
Well, you know, I got to tie one back to my wife. So, you know. So, you know, again, any popularity I might have is probably just going to be riding on my wife's coattails. So I got to work one in. But the first one I have, you know, I know you've done, what is it? Are you up to like 70 episodes now? I know there were a bunch of meanwhiles and that kind of
thing. It's something like that. Yeah, in that ballpark.
So, you know, there have been a lot of picks and a lot of strained tangents and that kind of thing. And I thought, and maybe this is a silly idea, but I thought rather than doing something where there was a very strained connection, that maybe I pick something that was more tonally similar with the Justice League. So my pick is, in fact, the Orville Library Edition Hardcover Volume 1. Part of the reason I picked that, you know, you've read a lot of comics. I've read a lot of comics. A lot of our listeners have read a lot of comics. Licensed comics are often looked at as somewhat lesser. Sometimes they're, you know, there to, you know, you could argue you exploit an audience who, you know, are going to buy it anyway, regardless of how good the creative team is. This is really good stuff. You know, it's pretty rare when you find something that's a licensed comic like that is this good. The thing I'm thinking back to is like the Gabriel Hardman and Corona Beck and Planet of the Apes stuff, something that really feels like the series they're coming from. Everything in this was literally good enough to be an episode of the actual TV show. So this is fantastic stuff. This is a hardcover collection. It has a suggested retail price of $49.99. It is 42% off at InStock Trades at $28.99, 280 pages. And I will also say, if you don't want to take the recommendation of some random guy on a podcast, there are also smaller trade paperbacks available if you want to get a little bit of a sampler instead of going for the whole, you know, deluxe edition or library edition hardcover. There is that. But I would highly recommend this as, you know, one of the best licensed comics I've read in a really, really long time. And if you love the series, you'll love this. There's no doubt in my mind.
Wow. It, you know, and the Orville seems like something that would adapt well for comics anyway. There's just, there's that level of humor and sometimes silliness, but, you know, adventure. Yeah, I could totally see how this would work. Yeah.
But the second pick I have, for totally different reasons, is actually the Savage She-Hulk Omnibus hardcover, the direct market edition variant. The reason I'm picking this is that this collects the entire original Savage She-Hulk series, plus there's like a Marvel 2-in-1 that she appears into. You get the whole series here. But this is a straight-up reprint of the Marvel Masterworks. There were two volumes of those. Both of those had introductions by David Anthony Kraft. And in one of those introductions, he quotes at length an academic named Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine.
Oh my gosh!
So my wife actually gets featured in this. So if you want to read more of her writing, this is a very expensive way to get it. But you know, the original Savage She-Hulk is very good too.
This is where you say my wife is worth it.
My wife is worth it, but you could buy this essay in another book too. But, you know, this is 648 pages. Now, there'll be no volume of two of this because this is the entire series, the entire Savage She-Hulk series. I'm sure there are sensational She-Hulk omnibuses, but they're omnibuys. I don't know how you even say that. But this will be the entire thing. So it's a one-shot deal. It is $100 list price at InStock Trades. It is $62 for 32% off.
Fantastic. That's awesome. Those are a great couple of suggestions. And I appreciate you bringing in those, and how cool that you could tie it directly back to your wife. That's probably a first on the show that anyone's been able to do that. So I'm impressed.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And I'm sure she will too. She doesn't get any royalty money from those, but you know, getting her name out there.
There you go. Exactly. That's what it's about, right? So folks, well, actually, no, it's probably about the royalties. Anyway, for folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your help through our Patreon. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast. So our thanks go out to Bill Beer, Chris Lewis, Chris Pine, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Gostilio, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, and Tim Price. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. All right, so we need to hear from you folks. You know, as I always say, this is not just my show. This is our show. So get on the social medias, share your thoughts on Breakdown, specifically parts 3 and 4. You know, get out there and talk about Tim, talk about his wife. You know, you can draw some of your own comparisons. It's not that hard. It's low-hanging fruit. And remember, it is all about building. It's all about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. Now, Tim, I got to ask you, so what is your personal origin story with the JLI? How did you find the book?
Well, I was one of those people who actually came in to comics from the 89 Batman movie.
Ooh.
That seems like quite a long time ago now. The first time...
just to be more exact, I mean, Michael Keaton is Batman in the theaters again, so it doesn't really feel like it's that long ago right now.
Yeah, he's quite a bit older now. So are we, though. Right.
He kept his hair, sort of, kind of.
Well, he did. He did. You know, I have a special affinity for Michael Keaton because he's a Pittsburgh guy. But anyway, I came into comics from Batman 89. The first time I actually saw JLI, the JLI was from a very obscure sampler that DC put out that was called Batman and Other DC Classics. Do you remember that one?
No, I don't. I'm wondering where this is going. I've never heard of this thing.
This thing was a free comic they put out, I think, in 1989 or 1990, that was a sampler for the burgeoning trade paperback market. And it had basically sections from 4 different trade paperbacks. There was a 40s Batman story from the greatest Batman stories ever told. There was an excerpt from Camelot 3000. There was a very pivotal scene from the New Teen Titans, the Judas Contract, the scene where Dick Grayson actually quits his Robin. And there was the one punch scene from Justice League International to promote the Justice League International, A New Beginning, or Justice League. It wasn't international at that point. It was Justice League, A New Beginning trade paperback. So that was actually my first exposure to the JLI, just that single scene.
Oh, wow. And by the way, I just Googled it. I'm looking at Batman and Other DC Classics, and I totally recognize this now. I absolutely recognize this, but I didn't remember it existed. So wow. So they had that scene from issue number 5 in there.
They had the scene in there. I think a little bit later than that, I was really, when Armageddon 2001 came out, that was my first big crossover. And I really got into that. And I remember actually after like an orthodontist appointment, waiting at a drugstore in the town that I grew up that was called Pleasant Hills near Pittsburgh, there was a drugstore there near DeStefano's, and they had the Justice League Annual 5 there, you know, even though it was beat to heck and it was $2, I bought it anyway, and I really ended up enjoying that. But I will also say that I was, I guess, 11 or 12, probably just about 12 when I started reading comics. I was really not down with the concept of the funny Justice League. Wait for the comments on that one.
Hey, you were not alone. There was many. I was one of those, too, at first.
I feel like somewhat that people who came in who were reading comics before the Batman movie and before Crisis, or before Legends, really, you know, the funny Justice Leagues, a lot of those people kind of got it what they were doing. You know, some of them didn't, but obviously there were enough people who got it to make the book a really good seller at the time. After the Batman movie, I don't think many of those people who came into comics from that got it at all.
Okay, sure.
At 12 or 13 years old, or 11 or 12, or whatever it is, you know, whatever age they call the golden age of comics, you know, the old joke, mm-hmm. the golden age of comics is 12. You know, I certainly wanted what was like a more grown-up version of the Super Friends. That's why, which is really, you know, 6 or 7 years later, what Grant Morrison ended up doing.
Yeah.
You know, which is really what I wanted at the time. But the Justice League International was always something that I'd heard about. I had a friend in high school who was really into it. He's like, well, you got to at least get issue 8 in Moving Day. I had the first trade paperback. I had the annual. You know, it was always one of those things. You know, I think there probably is something there as I kind of got a little older and wanted to go back and read that. It wasn't really until, it was right around when I got married. When Jenny and I got married, leading up to that, she liked comics. I liked comics. And, you know, I started buying some runs of stuff. At first for her, she was teaching a Superman class at the time. And my Superman run started at the death of Superman. And I went back and got basically everything post-Crisis up to the death of Superman. And I got my Wonder Woman run started around the Bill Loeb's and Mike Diodato, you know, contest stuff.
Sure.
And I went back and got all the Perez stuff for Wonder Woman too, and I got her a couple runs. And, you know, I was really grateful to have a wife who, instead of saying, hey, you know, you got to get rid of that crap, you know, was actually encouraging me to buy more. So I bought a couple runs, and I, well, you know, there's some things I might like. It's like, well, buy stuff for yourself too. So I kind of really got the bug at that point, and I started, got a bunch of runs. I got the entire Justice League International, you know, even all the quarterlies and that kind of thing, got a big run of those. I got the pre-Mark Wade Flash stuff that I didn't have, which I've heard was really good. I got some more obscure things. I got the Grell Green Arrow run. Mm-hmm. I got a book called Wasteland, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
And Del Close. Yep. He's like the godfather of every improv comedian known to man.
Exactly right.
You know, and that kind of thing. So I ended up, you know, buying a bunch of those. But the thing is, you know, I've literally been a Wednesday Warrior for 35 years. And there's always that pile of stuff. And there's, you know, I'll pick up some collections and some trade paperbacks and some runs with good intentions to read them and never really got back to it. Always thought, hey, I want to read those, but never really had the time until my wife went on your podcast. And then I, you know, read through a heck of a lot because it was her first podcast and she was frightened. And I like, well, at least I need to read these in solidarity, if nothing else, if, you know, not to say that I'm going to be able to help her or anything like that, you know, you know, at least, you know, read them in solidarity. So I read up to that point. And for this, I actually read everything up to this issue. I started with Legends. I did the crossovers. I did, you know, I did Millennium. I did Invasion. Did all the Secret Origin issues that tied in. Did the Martian Manhunter miniseries. I don't think I got to the Power Girl miniseries. I'll have to go back and read that at some point. I was even trying to read Suicide Squad too at the beginning, but it got to be too many things and this was coming up too soon. So yeah, but you know, I've read everything, so my brain is probably totally mush now, and I'll probably babble on for the next 20 minutes or so. So
that implies you haven't been already, but
fair enough.
So the sentence, so I read a bunch of comics because my wife was going to be on the podcast. I don't think that those words have ever been assembled before in that order before. So very exciting.
Well, we have a very unique relationship. Let's put it that way.
Right. No, I think every guy is sort of like, wow, I wish my better half would, like you described earlier, would not say get rid of that stuff, would encourage it. That it's very exciting.
So we now actually have over 30,000 comics. So
wow. Oh, that's amazing. See, I have a large large amount, and my wife's made it very clear to me that if the stack gets much bigger, they all just go to the street. So that's why I've become such a fan of digital.
Well, I actually did read almost all of these digitally leading up to this because it was more convenient. Now, mind you, sure. When we bought the house, I really did go through and make everything really accessible. I could probably pull out any comic I have in my collection in about 2 minutes.
Wow.
Because it's all short boxes on, well, they're the ones that are at Sam's Club are branded muscle racks. I think there's a similar thing you can get at Costco, those kind of racks. And, you know, we have, I think it's 175 short boxes or something like that right now.
So folks, you heard it here. The Schwartz Levine Library opens in this fall.
Yes, it does. And, you know, maybe I should give people my address too.
Would not recommend that.
Not these animals. I will joke about that, but I think you really have like a Goldfinger problem if that would happen, you know, because it would probably take about 8 guys, you know, 5 hours and a couple U-Hauls to get them all out of, you know, it's like in the book, they were like, hey, we're going to steal all, Goldfinger's going to steal all the money all the gold from Fort Knox. Well, and people point out that's not really practical, so they fixed it in the movie. Oh, he's just going to irradiate it and disrupt the gold supply. So I guess you could come here and blow up my house and disrupt the, you know, comics market or something like that.
No one do any of that, please. For the sake of the Schwartz Levines and the comic book market, for both the world's sake. So
they could just put a target on my back, right?
I would not be advertising myself as in that situation, but hey, you do you. Well, we should get into this, folks. So we are going to get into Justice League America number 54, which is labeled Breakdowns Part 3. Now, if you want to see some images from this, you can go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI, and some of the images from this issue will be out there. But hey, you can get this on the DC Infinite app. You can get this on Comixology. You can get this all kinds of places. Go buy the original comic. I mean, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to get your hands on this, folks. So it is Justice League America number 54, published by DC Comics, cover dated September 1991, on the shelves July 23rd, 1991. Cover price is $1, 4 shiny quarters. And the cover is by Chris Sprouse and P. Craig Russell. Wow, what a combination. Mm-hmm. You want to describe the cover for us?
The cover is primarily, it's an homage to a page from Amazing Spider-Man 50. It is Beetle and Isis Comics sitting in an outdoor urban trash can with them walking away from it out in the background there. It is very much a cityscape, a sidewalk, row of cars along them. And it is an homage to that famous image from Spider-Man, which was not, in fact, the cover, which makes it really interesting to me because I don't think there are many or hardly any cases of covers being homages to interior pages of comics. That is a really, really rare thing. I like to think I'm a pretty good researcher at these kind of things. I could not find any other instance other than this image from Amazing Spider-Man 50 that was homaged as a cover from an interior page.
I couldn't think of anything either. I got to tell you, it's interesting. I read ahead in your notes and I saw you reference this as an interior page. I'm like, what? No, yeah. Surely. I know. I was like, surely this is the cover of a Spider-Man. It's like in my head, it was the cover of a Spider-Man issue. And sure enough, I'm like, oh no, it is absolutely the interior splash page. And all these years, I just got it wrong.
Yeah. When I first looked at this, I was like, you know, you look at this. Oh yeah. That's the Amazing Spider-Man No More. It's Amazing Spider-Man mm-hmm. 50. And then, you know, I look at the image for Amazing. Yeah. That's right. That's not the cover. That's really interesting. You know, what's even more interesting is that the first time I believe this was homaged as a cover was another issue of Justice League. Hmm. It was from the Justice League of America 224. Now, that's an even looser homage, and I think a lot of people have more of a difficult time picking up on it because it's set in an alley, but the color is a little odd. You have, I think it's like Green Arrow and Red Tornado's costumes.
Well, it's actually Red Tornado. It's like torso. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a different angle, too, which kind of makes it, you know, a little bit more difficult to pick up. This isn't quite in an alley the way the Amazing Spider-Man image is, and it's not raining. training, but it's the same kind of perspective and angle that you're seeing it from in this.
I mean, it's absolutely, this is the spiritual successor as well. Because, I mean, in that case, Spider-Man was walking away from the Spider-Man costume, and here Ice and Blue Beetle are walking away. Whereas that Justice League of America one, 224, that's Paragon, and that's more like he had taken them out, like he defeated the Justice League and threw them in the trash. So this is absolutely much more of an homage, I think. And boy, I just love it. Like, Ted and Tora, and I call them that because they're in plain clothes, you know, they're walking away arm in arm, and there's nothing romantic about it. You just see the friendship. You see the emotional support, and it's just, it like, I get all kind of verklempt, like I'm getting all teary-eyed here. It's powerful.
It's a really good cover, and I have really grown to really like Chris Sprouse's stuff over the years. There was a Two-Face Origin Batman annual that he did. It was, I think, Batman Annual 14 that was a very seminal comic for me when I was growing up. I would still hold that up as probably the best companion piece to Batman Year One. And that was written by Andy Helfer, who obviously was the editor of the Justice League books as well. That's worth checking out if any of you have never read it. But, you know, I really have grown to appreciate Chris Sprouse's stuff.
I've been an easy mark for him for a long time. Like when he did the Legionnaire stuff, I was absolutely in love with his work.
I guess we should put it out as a scavenger hunt for the listeners that if anyone can actually find another interior page, an actual story interior page that was homaged as a cover, let us know, because I don't know if there really is one. This might be it.
Yeah, the closest I was able to come up with was, and this is so crazy, it was a Who's Who page. They're, you know, the loose leaf, right? So they are kind of like comic covers, but they weren't. There was one, and I want to say, now this is off the top of my head, folks, I want to say it was Lord Satanus. It was a Jurgens one, but he was homaging an interior page of a Star Wars comic.
Interesting.
There's a great page in one of the Star Wars comics where Darth Vader's coming out. He's like, Luke Skywalker, I've come for you. And he homaged it for, again, I think it was Lord Satanus, if I remember right. And that was so strange to me to homage an interior page.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the cover. So it still doesn't qualify.
Yeah, it's really, really rare because, you know, you think of all these seminal comic moments that people like to homage a lot, and it's always they're doing the cover.
Yep.
Except for this.
Well, folks, if you can think of one, definitely put it in the comments. I would love to hear what you guys are thinking on this one.
You know, I like to think I have pretty good internet searching skill. I work in IT. And, you know, it's like, I couldn't find anything. It's like, damn. I mean, I'm sure there's probably some like Neil Adams splash page somewhere, something like that, that got used, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, I think of the one, the Batman on the beach running, probably someone did a cover of that.
I'm sure Joe Brozowski swiped something that Neil Adams drew and put it on a cover, probably.
Yeah.
But as far as this one goes, you know, there's no cover copy on it at all. There's no Blue Beetle no more, any of that. It still just works. It tells the story you need to know.
Oh, yeah. It is a fantastic cover.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's open it up. Let's get inside. So, folks, this is, again, Justice League America number 54. Inside. Plot is by Keith Giffen. Scripts by J.M. DeMatteis. Penciler is Chris Wozniak. Inker is Bob Smith. Letter is Bob LePan. Colors to Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Kevin Dooley. And editor is Andy Helfer. The comic itself is Breakdowns Part 3, and the issue title is The Boot. You want to start us off, Tim?
Okay. We open with Heimlich just about to leave the Bialyan embassy after having successfully negotiated the release of Captain Atom with Ambassador Fizar. On the limo ride back to the New York JLI embassy, Heimlich calls Sue Dibny at the London embassy and instructs her to make sure that Captain Atom's things are packed and that he has been deleted from the computer data bank before he returns. We cut to Bialya with sort of kind of not really Jack Lantern discussing his conspiracy with Suman Arjavati. Suman believes that he is the rightful heir to Bialya and wants the throne. Stand-in Jack wants sole control of the Global Guardians. They both believe that retribution being sought again for Queen Bee will set a chain of events into motion that will get them both what they want. Meanwhile, Inspector Camus is escorting a powered-down Captain Atom out of Bialya and reminds him that his release is contingent upon him not turning into Captain Atom. Aboard the plane, slightly after takeoff, Captain Atom notices a note with the word boom taped to something on the back of the seat in front of him, and the plane abruptly explodes. Poor Captain Atom and Inspector Camus, we barely felt like we knew you. We cut to the New York embassy where the team is waiting around to have the mandatory one-on-one interviews that Heimlich has insisted that they have with him. Ted is particularly anxious about what will happen. In the first interview with John, Heimlich informs him that all of his decisions as field commander will now go through him and that he should be addressed as Sir by John. John retorts that he'll only address him as Sir when he's earned it. In General Glory's interview, Heimlich initially tells Glory how delighted he is to have him as a member, but begins to reconsider as Glory starts to bore him with old war stories and old war stories and old war stories. In Ted's interview, Heimlich calls Ted a disgrace to this team and summarily fires him. While Ted is being dressed down, the only word he is able to get in edgewise is, but, and we end the scene with Ted standing out of the door, still saying, but, and giving him a one-fingered salute. In Bee's interview, we open the door with her striking a flirtatious pose as she enters, and after four panels behind closed doors, it is clear that she has used her seductive charms not only to retain her position on the team, but also to earn a raise. Guy's interview goes just about as expected, with Heimlich practically having an aneurysm at Guy's posturing. Yet somehow, Guy is able to keep his position on the team.
Well, I'll take it from here. So Heimlich's next meeting is with Ice, where he explains that she is too sweet and too kind and not cut out for superheroing. And therefore, she's the next to be fired. Then Ice and Beetle commiserate and decide to say their goodbyes to the team together. The remaining members of the team, which are Martian Manhunter, Fire, Guy Gardner, and General Glory, are shocked when Heimlich announces the League's newest members have arrived. New members? That's right, without consulting anyone, Heimlich has recruited the Tasmanian Devil and the new Dr. Light. Later, the Tasmanian Devil tries to spread some goodwill with Guy Gardner, and Guy responds pretty much as a jackass. So Tasmanian Devil decks him, knocking him across the sitting room of the embassy. Now, while they're not shown, we could probably assume that some doilies went flying as well. Meanwhile, at the hospital, Ted Gord and Tora Olof's daughter visit with Maxwell Lord, who remains unconscious, barely clinging to life. Ralph Dibny arrives to recruit Ted and Tora, saying the ex-Justice Leaguers have got a job to do. A recently terminated trio of Leaguers secretly transport over to the London Embassy, where they're met by Sue Dibny. The fired foursome covertly head for the Revson Cosmetics building, which is the offices of Crimson Fox's alter ego. Upon arrival, we're treated to a full splash page of Captain Atom and Inspector Camus very much alive. Turns out Captain Atom managed a last-minute escape for himself and Inspector Camus. The investigations conducted by Camus indicate that the bullets that shot Max originate from Bealia, which suggests a link to the Queen Bee. While the exploding plane seems to remove any doubts in the ex-Leaguers' minds that the Queen Bee is responsible. It's time for the Furloughed Five, which is Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Ice, Elongated Man, and Crimson Fox, to head to Bealia to put the Queen Bee out of commission for good. Next issue, Royal Jelly. Oof, man. A lot going on in this one. What'd you think?
I liked it. You know, even though this is chapter three, it really feels like we're kind of into the middle of this story. Mm-hmm. This issue was really more about moving plot forward and, you know, having things happen that we're going to set up consequences for later, which is really fine with me. You know, I'd probably give this maybe about a 7 out of 10. I think it did a good job of moving the story forward, and we're into the less, more build around jokes type of JLI into this is we're building toward a serious story. Here. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking as you were reading the recap, you know, if only Heimlich would have read, you know, Human Target, he wouldn't have thought that Ice was so sweet and kind. But
true. Yeah. If he had that foreknowledge, he would have perhaps handled that a little differently.
You know, I don't know. You know, continuity and what's available works different in story. So
without any spoilers, would you care to tell the people at home your thumbs up, thumbs down on Human Target?
Actually, I really did enjoy it. I certainly understand that how Tom King has a reputation of basically mischaracterizing some of the characters, kind of betraying some of the characters. In some cases, I can be a little bit of an apologist for that. I know it's very well known that he did not get to choose the characters that things happened to in Heroes in Crisis. You know, it's very well known that that was editorially mandated. But I kind of really feel like I love noir comics. This is Human Target was probably, I would go as far as to say, the best noir comic I've ever read. And, you know, as far as mischaracterizing the characters, when it's this good, I kind of don't care.
All right, folks, go ahead and eviscerate him in the comments.
Yes.
No, don't do that. Play nice. He's one of our own people.
And quite frankly, if I don't want to get spoilery, but
you're not gonna, because I haven't finished it.
But let's just say that if you've been reading all the way since Justice League International and you haven't figured out that dead characters always come back, I'm not really sure what you're doing, folks. So why you're getting that angry when someone supposedly gets killed, I don't know. You know,
the best superhero funeral ever was in Final Crisis when Superman wished Martian Manhunter a speedy resurrection. So, but let's talk about this comic instead.
Well, yeah, and as the mantra goes, dead characters don't sell comics. Go figure.
Yeah, okay. So you made an important point about how this moved the plot forward, and on the second reading of this issue, I really picked up on one particular page, and I'm like, wait a minute, did they just reveal everything right here? On page 3, Jack-O-Lantern says the line, they're talking about, you know, what they're doing with trying to frame the Queen Bee, right? Him and Hardjavati. Jack-O-Lantern says that alone was worth knocking Max Lord out of the box.
Yes.
So did Jack-O-Lantern just admit, at least to us in the audience, that he is the one who shot Maxwell Lord? Because that's what it sounds like to me.
This was the last issue I read, so I do not, other than really broad strokes, I don't know anything that happened after this. So I'm coming to this from that perspective. There are two things I thought about that. One was, it feels like there's more going on here than what's really kind of in front of us. And the other is that this Jack-O-Lantern, that is not the original Jack-O-Lantern, which was some guy who was being brainwashed or controlled, or maybe was just a volunteer.
Folks, hang around for the second half of this episode, where our guest is going to do a whole character spotlight on Jack-O-Lantern. So all that will be explained.
Yeah, but I think he kind of really does fit the definition of an unreliable narrator pretty well in this case. So, and again, I don't know. I'm not trying to telegraph anything because I did not read the stuff after this, but I'd be highly suspect that that's all there is. But obviously, history may have already proved me wrong. So.
Well, folks, don't answer that one in the comments, because I don't know either. I still don't know who killed Max. I want to find out reading the issues myself. So you can talk around it, just don't do the spoilers.
The only thing I really didn't like here was the whole joke that they had about Ralph and Crimson Fox having an affair. And I thought that was, there wasn't enough setup for that. And it was way too out of left field and totally took me out of the story. Like, what?
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of the few jokes that really I thought landed flat in the entire book. If I was editor, I would have cut that, because I thought that just totally took me out of the story, because there was all the setup for this would have happened off panel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for this joke, and all of a sudden this is what Beetle gravitates on. Well, how are you guys here together? We're having an affair. You know, you having an affair, you know, I really didn't like that, but that's just personal preference, probably.
I laughed. Part of it, I love Crimson Fox and her sex positive, you know, forward leanings, and then Ralph and is so obviously dedicated to Sue that everyone knows there wouldn't happen. The joke probably would have worked better if Sue was there, and Sue could have had some sort of reaction, be like, yeah, why were you here, Ralph, or whatever. But I can see where it may not have been your favorite joke. I laughed, but then I'm a crude jerk, and it's right there in the name. I'm irredeemable, so.
Well, you know, and I don't even think the crude part. It's just, this was too kind of, to me, it was just really out of left field and took me out of the story, you know, and, you know, you can do that, but it has to be really funny.
Well, I did like, just a couple of pages before, the same banter, but done in a much more fun way, which on page 17 was Ted and Ralph were running to the car, getting ready to go to the Revson place. And Ralph's like, you know, don't tell me where we're going. Or Ted goes, I'm sorry, don't tell me where we're going. It's more fun, you know, to play the spy game. And so they're like making Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Get Smart references, talking into their shoes. I found that, and it was all in the dialogue. You couldn't actually see what they were doing. I thought it was hysterical.
You know, I'll tell you what, I saw your notes on that, and from the first couple times I read that, I didn't even retain that, to be honest. I don't know. There's a part of me that if you're going to do references like that, they should be a little bit more clever.
So I'm going to need you to go ahead and just take the headset off. And if you could go find Jenny and we could finish the show a lot more interesting. I'm just saying.
Sorry, man.
Man from Uncle holds a very special place in my heart. You just stepped into a very dangerous area.
I'm not saying anything, but it's at most a name drop. It's not a clever reference.
Well, first of all, at this point, Man from Uncle and Get Smart would have been more timely, at least in the reruns. And it's just a fun reference, like, because they're getting to play spies.
Yeah. But my opinion is, I totally get that. And they're throwing, but, do something, a little bit more clever, but, to reference.
Fair enough.
I watched a lot more Get Smart growing up than Man from Uncle, but, certainly both of those have, places in my heart, but I didn't find them to be clever references at all. They were just kind of more like just random name drops than references. Yeah.
Well, I liked it, damn it. You're wrong. So there.
Okay.
That's my clever, intelligent argument. What else you got, buddy?
Okay, well, I think we're going to get into the art here.
Let's do this. Now, as a precursor, hold on, folks. Okay. You remember Breakdowns Part 1 was Chris Wozniak's first issue on the book. And the guest and I, Michelle Fife, we had some criticism to make about Wozniak and how we said a lot of positives as well. But we said some criticism about how jarring it was a transition. Now, this is his second issue. Let's have this discussion. You start us off.
Well, okay. I think there's a little rewriting history there. It seemed to me like you were slamming it pretty bad.
Maybe so. We had so many Meanwhile episodes in between. It's been months since I recorded that. I don't even remember.
Because when I listened to that, I was like, wow, they really didn't like this guy. I don't want to come off as an apologist for Wozniak's art. I just want to call balls and strikes. And I certainly have read a lot of comics and read a lot of comics with really bad art in my day. And I wouldn't call this bad art. At worst, even in that issue, this issue was much better than that issue, by the way. But even in that issue, I'd call it at worst maybe serviceable. It didn't really get in the way of the story. It kind of, it was there. It wasn't something I would particularly gravitate for, I think.
And just to clarify, you're talking about issue 53 at this point still, right? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of stylistic choices that he made that are not right for this book. I can see there's some leaning into the trend of, big muscles and everyone's really big and TNA and that type of thing. And that was very big at the time. But I wouldn't compare his art as being closer to like the Image guys. To me, this art really reminded me more of someone like Scott Eaton or a Val Semex or someone like that.
Okay, I can see that.
Draw kind of bulky characters. I thought of that and, this issue more so. And, the thing that just occurred to me when I was looking stuff up last night that, one of the names, I thought this was like was Val Semex, and Bob Smith is inking this issue. And Bob Smith's regular gig at this point was actually inking The Demon, where he was inking Val Semex.
Oh, wow.
Go figure. So maybe some of that carried over. How much of this is being redrawn in this issue versus inking, or how heavy-handed the inking is a question. Even in the previous issue, again, I wouldn't call it bad art. This issue is much better. And some of my perception of the previous issue, I think, was colored by the fact that I did read 54 before I read 53. So I'm kind of looking at the art from the perspective of having looked at the better one first and kind of going with it after that. I think a lot, the inks do play a lot into here, because the first time I ever encountered Chris Wozniak's art, he was doing a couple fill-in issues of a book called Gunfire. I don't know if you remember that.
Bloodlines.
Yeah, one of the new blood characters from Bloodlines. And he was one of the new blood characters who got a book because he got a book. wasn't particularly one of the better characters or more fan favorite characters. I mean, Len Wein was writing in, you like Len Wein, and I think all, one of the great Bronze Bronze Age guys, but it was an okay book. But the two issues that Wozniak did, he inked himself, and man, they were atrocious. You know, I went back and looked at them, you know, a couple weeks ago, and like, yeah, they were as bad as I remember. This is much better than that. And again, I wouldn't even call this, even though proportions are exaggerated. You know, I particularly didn't like the way he drew ice, even in this issue. It was a much more sexualized ice, the way he drew her breasts and that kind of thing, which I don't really think works for the character as much. You know, again, I will say, if I wanted a more sexualized ice, I would definitely go with the way Greg Smallwood drew her in Human Target. But no more spoilers on that.
Well, I will say, you know, as I mentioned, we were critical. And apparently very critical, according to some sources, of Wozniak last issue, last time, in Breakdowns Part 1. But I will say, this issue, I really, really like his art. I was shocked how much I enjoyed. Now, I'm not saying he's, you know, better than Adam Hughes or Kevin McQuire, but I'm saying from the previous issue to this one, I was very surprised. Like, the best expression I can use here is it's restraint in all the right places. Mm-hmm. He really restrained where he needed to. There's this whole thing with the beefy characters I want to get into here. Yeah. So General Glory and Jean are drawn massively beefy, right?
Yes.
Which works.
And, yeah, it does.
And this time, unlike last issue, Ted and Guy are still muscular, but are on a significantly smaller scale, which is what they need to be.
And I also want to interject here that the scene where you see John as being really beefy is his interview with Heimlich.
Yeah.
And the fact is, John is a shapeshifter. So if he wants to convey intimidation, he could probably actually make himself be more beefy.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about that scene in just a second, because I had a light bulb go off last night as I was getting ready for this on that. But let me finish my thoughts real quick before interrupted.
Sorry.
So in addition to all that, you've got Fire and Crimson Fox are smoking hot the way they're drawn, because they're both very sex positive characters. Tasmanian Devil definitely fits Wozniak's style, right? The big beefy character.
Yeah.
The new Dr. Light, I think he's still trying to figure out how to draw that character probably. It's probably the first time.
You know, I do want to say that version of the costume looks like a coloring error to me.
Oh, there's definitely a coloring error on there. Yeah, without a doubt. But it still looks like he's even trying to figure out some of the line work, I think.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that is really interesting is, and we noticed this last time, is that the way he draws regular people, though, is fantastic. So Heimlich, Ambassador Fizier, Harjavati, Inspector Camus, they all look great. In fact, if you look at the superheroes in this issue, the team, when they're in plain clothes, you get Nathaniel Adam, who's in human form. You get Ted Kord, Tara, Ralph. Again, they all look great. But once Captain Adam's revealed in the armored form of page 19, he's back to being massively beefy. So what's going on here is the artist is making a conscious choice that superheroes are larger than life. And regular people look great, look normal, and I dig it. It really works here.
Well, and even the regular people are kind of pulled back from last issue, because they are less exact. Even to some extent, in the last issue, the regular people were more exaggerated. I wouldn't say I love the artwork, but I think it served the story pretty well. I think it's fair to say that if you look at the Justice League, JLI, JLA book, he's probably the weakest regular penciler on the book. I would probably say that.
That's possible. I could, given all the other ones, you're probably right.
Yeah, I think everyone was pretty strong comparatively. I didn't have any huge problems with the art. And, you know, these are deadline-oriented monthly comics, and they got to get done what they got to get done, you know, in and out every month. So,
and even if he was the weaker of the artists, this issue is such a huge improvement from last issue that it merits being acknowledged. So, all right, I got to talk about the interviews here. So if you got your copy handy, flip to the interview starting on page 7, right?
Yeah, I have it digitally. I have my the paper copy in reach, too.
So. Perfect. Okay, so they do 6 interviews in here. And last episode of Breakdowns, we praised the interviews in the Justice League Europe book that Derek Robertson did. I'm going to praise the interviews again, because what you get 6 interviews all with the exact same layout. Mm-hmm. So what it is you get a split screen. Far left side is one long, tall panel, and then the right is five smaller rectangular stacked panels. And the panel on the left is the key. If you flip through the interviews and look at every single one of these interviews, the left panel is not only the same shape, it's the same establishing shot. It is the bookcase on the left. It is the pictures on the wall behind them. Mm-hmm. It is all the characters in the same place. And this is where you get to see some of the really cool stuff Wozniak actually did. It shows you the physical differences in each character. You mentioned earlier, Martian Manhunter is so big, he fills every inch of that frame, right? You can't see anything behind him. You go to the next page, and General Glory's a little bit smaller. Suddenly, you can see the mirror on the wall, or the picture on the wall behind him. And then you keep going. Beetle is much smaller, and now you can see both pictures on the wall. You get to the point, you know, where Ice is the smallest. And so, he's showing you the size of the characters by repeating the exact same establishing shot for each interview. It's showing you the style, how each character comes in. Like, Martian Manhunter is very, very aggressive. You know, General Glory saluting. Ice is flirtatious. You're seeing everyone's persona, and I'm like, dang, like, I'm really impressed with how he laid out these six pages.
I will say, in fairness, some of the bigness of Martian Manhunter is the cape you're seeing, though. It's really not that much bigger than drawn that much bigger than Glory. But no, I think this is, and you know, I think it was a really good choice to give each of these a full page in this issue, because they only got like three panels in the Justice League Europe issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was a really good choice. But I'll kind of segue, if you will, here to one of my other points here, because you know, Wozniak isn't the person to praise for this layout. It's Giffen.
Oh, that's fair. That's very fair.
Because one of the points that I wanted to make, and maybe this is an awkward transition, I know you've said so many times, you know, about how strong the facial expressions are in Justice League. And I actually had a thought about that. One of the things that I was thinking about, and I totally agree, the facial expressions through the entire thing are fantastic. Some of that is obviously to sell the comedy, because you do need that to sell the comedy.
Sure.
But one of the other things I was thinking about is, I mean, I'm going to overstate the obvious just to kind of lay the groundwork for this, but obviously we should think of comics pencilers and illustrators as more people who are storytellers as opposed to just people who draw pretty pictures, right?
You know, yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Everyone should. I think everyone who's paying attention to comics should probably feel that way. But one of the things is, when we talk about comic storytelling, or don't a lot of times, it's one of those things that gets talked around a heck of a lot. You know, what exactly does that mean? And I think if you kind of break that down, when you're talking about storytelling, you're talking about how the panels are laid out, kind of how the pacing happens in terms of panels based upon how tight the script is. You're talking about the angles that you're getting the shots from. You're talking about some of the character acting, you know, what the theater term they'd use is blocking for positioning of the characters. And you're talking, and you're talking about, you know, the emotion that's conveyed through facial expressions. Now, if you think about the Justice League books, almost all of those things are already in the breakdowns to start with. So really, the main penciler's real only significant contribution to the storytelling is the facial expressions. So, you know, so you would think, okay, if you're the editor on the book, you're going to want to hire someone who's really good at that. And if you're the penciler, you're going to want to really try hard on that, because that is your contribution to the storytelling that sets you apart just from a person who's drawing pretty pictures.
Okay. Interesting idea. So Andy Helfer had a real talent for finding people who did amazing facial expressions. So do you think that was part of his plan, knowing that the facial expression is what's going to carry the book and Keith's going to carry the design?
I think so. Or you could, you know, you could hire people who are really good at that and weren't necessarily good at structuring layouts, or weren't experienced enough to structure layouts or something like that. And I'm not, you know, I don't want to, you know, say anything about, you know, the pencilers on any of these books, because I'm sure they're fantastic at all kinds of things. And I don't want to, you know, disparage their ability to do anything. But, you know, they could definitely lean on Keith Giffen for that part. And plus, you're going to give the pencilers a lot more time too. I mean, I just listened to an interview with Brian Hitch probably a couple weeks ago, where he was talking about his process. And, you know, he was, and Brian Hitch, you know, for those of you who don't know, went from being really, really, really slow to wicked fast. I think Brian Hitch says he can do a 20-page book in 2 weeks now.
Wow.
But he says that he spends literally half of his time on layouts and fixing all of the problems with the artwork. And then he spends, you know, spend 1 week doing that and another week just rendering all the pencils. And so for some artists, if you can just go in there and draw stuff and you don't have to figure all that out, I think it would make a lot of them faster, because it seems like a lot of the artists who are slow, some of that, I mean, if it's George Perez, it's because you're drawing extremely detailed stuff. But a lot of the other artists who are slow because I think sometimes takes them a long time to figure out how to do the pages.
Yeah, another term in addition to blocking is breaking the story. Yeah, when you have to break the story down and figure out how to convey it as a visual medium. And you're right, Keith did save them a lot of times. And some of those artists, you know, if you look at Kev McGuire and Adam Hughes are the two I always go back to, both of them were brand new, you know. And so having Keith's, you know, breakdowns, you know, having his experience and breakdowns was a huge benefit.
Yeah, there's almost like an apprenticeship aspect to it.
Yeah, kind that's of, fair.
You know, it's very ironic, though, that, you know, that Keith Giffen is plotting this. And he's doing these really tight breakdowns for the pencilers to follow. But when he was like penciling Legion of Superheroes for Paul Levitz, he would read the script once, leave the script on the bus, only pencil what he remembered.
Right. I heard him say that on his podcast not very long ago. It's almost exactly how he described it. Yeah.
When I'm penciling, if it was interesting enough for me to remember, I'd draw it. When someone else is penciling for me, you know, I have it down to the grid, to the nine panel grids in what direction the characters are facing.
Oh, wow.
We love you, Keith.
I'm pretty confident he's not listening. Don't worry.
Yes, I know.
So I will say there is an amazing airplane explosion, which is really neat the way they rendered it. It almost looks like it's barely inked. It's mostly done in colors and really thin lines, and it just looks awesome. And another credit to Wozniak on this. And so you mentioned it earlier about Bob Smith inking this issue. Because, yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest differences. Because, yeah, Bruce Patterson inked him last time. And I think Bob Smith is probably a really good fit for Wozniak. It elevates the work.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, it's weird because Bob Smith is never really an inker that I've thought that much about prior to this, to be quite honest with
Okay.
you. Now, I'm trying to think. He's probably most famous for inking the three Robin miniseries that came out.
Oh, the Tom Lyle stuff?
Yeah, the Tom Lyle stuff. And he did a little bit of stuff on the, I think, you know, like in the 10s or 20s on the regular book to eventually he was on that. But, you know, I've never really thought that much about his inking, but clearly there's something here that he's able to kind of, you know, rein this in and make it look really good, you know, compared to the previous issue.
Yeah. And the word I think that is right is restraint. I mean, that's the perfect word for this. So I just want to say, I really enjoyed the art in this issue. And, you know, looking forward, I really hope Wozniak continues to demonstrate this level of restraint in the following issues. And this is the part where you would hear the voice of the narrator from Arrested Development say, "As it turns out, the artist very much does not show restraint in the next issue." So, yeah, I peeked ahead. Wow. We've got a lot to talk about when we get to JLA 55, folks. But back to some of the story elements. You mentioned Blue Beetle being fired. And talk about this hand gesture that you private messaged me about even.
Yes. Now, I don't know if we found something here. I read this the first time digitally. I have a paper copy sitting right next to me, too. I've had the paper copy for years, and I read it legally digitally through the DC app. Just to point that out in case anyone's listening. If you zoom that in, that is not the index finger he's holding up against that door. I don't know if that was something that was snuck in. I would certainly concede that him holding up an index finger while he's saying, but probably fits the context of the story more. But if you zoom that guy in, that's not what he's doing.
Unless he's got a really bulging knuckle.
Yeah. Now, I've never heard anything about this before. You know, there's a question of how did they sneak this by the comics code? Although, you know, for the best of my understanding, and I might have the chronology wrong, the comics code at this point was basically one person working at a PR firm that all the companies sent the comics.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Sent the comics to. And, you know, I think it was a lady who stayed on until, you know, she was, I think, late middle age by the time they stopped doing the comics code, like in the early 2010s and that kind of thing. But, you know, you got to think that how many books is this poor lady getting every day, and, you know, and getting them like via probably like third generation faxes and that kind of thing. Cause this is the time when IPO fever was happening at Marvel too. And they were just pumping out books like crazy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Not even the speculation boom, but they were trying to make their numbers look better because they were going to do an initial public offering and get everyone had stock options and that kind of thing. So there were just tons and tons and tons of, I mean, it might have been Marvel was up to like 200 books a month or something like that at that point. You know,
it was a large crazy number.
It was crazy.
But in this case, it is one small panel. It's, you know, one fifth of a panel essentially is what you're, or of the page.
Yeah. And the printing was so muddy back then.
Exactly.
Too.
So
printing was so muddy, but I think they might have snuck something in there.
It know? Could very well have been. It could have been. So after the terminations, I really like where Beetle and Ice sort of comfort each other, and you know, they decide to say goodbye together to the team. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it's that page that's getting to me, which makes me get, you know, choked up on the cover, or whether the cover was so powerful it makes this page get me choked up. But the combination of the cover and this page, again, where they're walking arm in arm, it just gets to me. It just really mm-hmm. does.
It was kind of a bittersweet moment. You know, I certainly can see that.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing is, does this count as the first LGBTQ JLA-er?
Tasmanian Devil, you mean?
Yeah.
Think now that I'm thinking about it. Now certainly there's been some retcons here and there about whatever, yeah. But at this point, Tasmanian Devil is out because it was in the Who's Who entries in the annual. So yeah, I think you're right.
It wasn't explicit, and it was every trope in the world.
Right. Yeah. They weren't hiding it. You know, they weren't even trying to be clever. They were, yeah, they're being fun.
They threw every trope, including the kitchen sink, you know, at this. You know, and I wonder if there was some editorial pushback on whether or not they were going to do that, be completely explicit about it at the time, if there was, you know, disagreements among the creators, or the fact that when they're locked into this giant 15-part story and, you know, the meter's running and you can only work in so many subplots, and some things may have been introduced with good intentions that never got paid off.
Yeah, I do wonder about Dr. Light and Tasmanian Devil, specifically why Giffen and DeMatteis chose to add them to the team mm-hmm. at this point. And, you know, maybe it will pay off later, or maybe it's just, you know, these are characters they liked and they thought that, and they were available.
It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, I do like the Tasmanian Devil then took to knock Guy Gardner across the room.
That was very satisfying.
It really was. It was very cathartic. I mean, like, ridiculously so.
Very satisfying. There are certainly aspects of Guy Gardner where I would say that if this was not done as a book for laughs a lot of the time, and you take some of his actions in a serious book, he's in that gray area where he's almost beyond an anti-hero some of the time.
Oh yeah, he's absolutely horrible. I've said many times on the show that he's the kind of character you like to read about, yeah, but you would never want to hang out with in real life.
If this was a straight, not half of it's for laughs type of book, he'd practically be a villain.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, totally.
And let's see the comments on that one. Yeah.
Hopefully they've gotten that out of their system in the last 7 years, but we'll find out, won't we?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about these ex-Justice Leaguers for a second here. So one thing that occurred to me, and this happens when you read a comic and you have to make notes for it to get ready for a podcast, you start to see stuff you never saw. Like in this book, you know, the ex-Justice Leaguers, they transport over to the London Embassy, right?
Mm-hmm.
how did they get access to the New York teleporter then to do that? Because Heimlich wasn't going to let him in there and use their machine. I guess someone could have snuck him in, but...
Yeah, I guess the question is, I don't think Heimlich is watching the door. I mean, I think all of the other team members would let them in. You know, you think there's a single team, maybe Guy, but, you know, the rest of them would have let them back in, I would think.
Quite possibly. And then the other thing is, you know, there's that, once those ex-Justice Leaguers get over to London, they go to the Revson Corporation, and then they open the door, and there's that great reveal of Captain Atom, Inspector Camus, which is a great reveal, by the way, because you, as the reader, you think they're dead. You get this great big splash page of them together. Captain Atom's bigger than life. I mean, it's one of these where Wozniak's drawing him huge. It looks great. Crimson Fox looks sexy, and she's also got that knowing smile, like, haha, they're alive, which is great. But I realized, again, making notes, that no one ever talked in this issue about Captain Atom and Inspector Camus dying. Like, it happened. The reader saw it. Mm-hmm. But there is never a single reference to it in the book. So as far as we know, Blue Beetle and Dibny and everyone, they wouldn't know that Captain Atom is supposed to be dead. So really, that big reveal was for us, not for them.
Well, I would give you a little bit of a devil's advocate here that... As I've been reading the entire breakdown story, there is a heck of a lot of plot points that happen off panel here.
Yes.
So if the book is implying that it happened off panel, then I'd say it probably did happen off panel, that they did find out somehow.
Well, we don't even get that revealed. They show up, they see them, and they could be reacting going, oh, you're not in Bialgi anymore. They could be reacting to that. But then they actually give us like a whole page of Blue Beetle recounting the story. He's just been told, going, so you're telling me you were in a plane that blew up. So, I mean, like, I don't think they ever heard the news.
Maybe not.
Now, by next issue, or by the Justice League Europe issue, we will catch up with that. And, obviously, I've prepared for that because I'm about to talk about it. So that is publicized then. But at this point, it hadn't been. So either way, still makes a heck of a splash page. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we have talked this one quite a bit. And we are at the point now, Tim, where we have to decide, as we do with all the breakdowns parts. You know, as I say, breakdowns has a very divisive reputation. Some folks love it. But, you know, a lot of folks carry some hard feelings for the story. So does this issue of breakdowns deserve the bad reputation, or is it better than most folks remember? What do you think?
Oh, I don't think it deserves the bad reputation. I get the controversy of breakdowns, though, because I, you know, reading this, there's an abrupt shift for breakdowns where it really does feel like almost totally different book. Mm-hmm. And I get how readers who have been reading this and used to at the most like 3-issue arcs, or maybe I guess they did 5 for General Glory, you know, and lots of jokes and lots of funny bits, and we're getting into more serious stuff, that, you know, this is something different, and this is not the JLI book that I want to be getting. And they didn't like it. You know, I think a lot of the readers were able to roll with it as well, but it is kind of the process of winding down the series too.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And so you're willing to say that this issue is a stand-up member of the positive breakdowns community. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I think if you take it as it is, if you're expecting what was, you know, happening like around issue 25 to still be happening, I understand why people, you know, wouldn't like it. But on its own merits, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, I give it a thumbs up. I think this is a great issue. Now, it's part 3, so we're still really early in the breakdowns plot. But as you mentioned right from the top, there's a lot of story packed in here. A lot of things are moving forward. You know, we're seeing Jack-O-Lantern and Harjavati, you know, plotting the explosion with the plane, the awesome, awesome interviews with the members, the introduction, you know, people getting fired and kicked off the team and new members, and then the ex-leaguers teaming up. So I found this one to be a lot of fun. And again, the art for me was a step up from the previous one. So I really felt like there's a great trajectory here.
I still have to wonder why he kept Guy.
Well, because the story needed it. I mean, come on. The two members of the Justice League, I always think of, when I think of Justice League America, the Wahaha era, my default is always Guy Gardner and Blue Beetle. Now, the rest of them are obviously critical, and any argument can be made why someone else is more important. But in my mind, those are the two I think of.
Well, yeah. And, you know, doing a long read through with this, it really did, you know, shock me how much Booster wasn't in it.
Yeah. Too. I think it was issue 37 when he quit, if I remember right.
Yeah, that he was gone for a long time. And, you know, it always was cemented in my mind that this JLI was, you know, Guy, Booster, Beetle, Fire and Ice.
Mm-hmm. They were the lead characters in the book who did not have their own ongoing series. So anything could happen to them. And they're the ones who probably had the most character development.
And I guess also, you know, they were the ones that carried over post-breakdowns and post-The Spectacular.
Well, that's true.
You know, in the Jurgens run until he basically, you know, shoved them into basically the wood chipper known as Doomsday.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a fair portrayal of what Jurgens did with the book, but that's a whole different discussion. But what we are going to do now is we are going to do the...
Wahaha Award.
This is where we're going to nominate the funniest moment of the issue. Both myself and Tim will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Wahaha Award. Tim, you're the guest this time, unfortunately. So you get to pick first. What do you got?
I'll tell you what. The Tasmanian and Devil punching guy was really, really satisfying. But I'm going to pick my Wahaha moment for all the wrong reasons. And that would be Beetle's one-fingered salute. I just... laughed like a middle schooler at that one. Yeah. Hey, they snuck that in.
So you're going to pick the potential art thing that might be there or might be just your own interpretation. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I am going to go with a more intentional joke, which also kind of fits with my name being irredeemable, is during the interviews, the page with Fire. You go from what you have several interviews before her, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, so you kind of know the pattern of the interviews, and you get to hers, and like you said, she comes in all flirtatious, and then you just get four panels of a closed door. So you don't know what's going on in the room, and she comes out and says, thank you ever so much for the raise. And it's just riotously funny because you know she has played him like a harp. She is completely in control of that situation.
Well, you gotta think, if Heimlich actually is a Nazi, and I haven't read far enough to know, if he is in fact, she's Brazilian, and it was like Argentina and Brazil where all those Nazis after World War II went to hang out. So I could see him having an extra affinity for Brazilian women, too.
I like your logic. That's pretty good. I like that. And I have to say that's the moment. And again, I'm not implying that anything happened behind the closed doors. I doubt that entirely. I think she just played him and, you know, used her feminine wiles to get what she wanted. And I'm not saying she did anything inappropriate at all. I don't think she would have. She would have only done what she wanted to do. She was in control.
Well, they referenced it. They haven't referenced it much at all in the JLI book, but when they did that Secret Origins issue, before she had powers, she was a spy who practiced in the art of seduction, you know, even more so than James Bond, I think.
So, yeah, she's got the knowledge and she's got the skills. And again, her looks is just another weapon to her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so,
sure. Yep. Sure.
All right, so now we got to decide which is going to win the accidental maybe panel that you zoomed in on, or this brilliantly executed full page, really multi-page epic that leads to this funny bit. So, you know, hey, what do you think?
I don't know, because this multi-page epic, you know, really was, you know, four shots of the door photo static next to each other. So I did like how you framed it there, but
yeah, you like that?
Four of the same panels photostatted onto the page. And, you know, the first panel and the last panel were funny. I will certainly say that I laughed more at, hey, they stuck that in there. So that would probably be my pick.
Why don't we call this one a draw? Because they're both during the interviews. They're both sort of the similar layout. And who cares? You know, it's just for fun. Fire and Blue Beetle, congratulations. Or I should say, Fire's Feminine Wiles and Blue Beetle's Middle Finger, congratulations. You have both won the coveted Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, Tim, I got to ask a favor. With literally everything falling apart here with the JLI, whether it be the team members or the fact that the X-Leaguers somehow got in and used the teleporter without anyone noticing, I mean, would you mind checking out the computer systems for a bit? You mentioned your IT, right? So I just need to make sure they're not falling apart as well.
Well, hold on. Have they tried turning them off and back on again first?
I love the IT crowd and the fact that you work with computers.
Yes. Yes. As I tell, you know, a lot of times people will go into my office and say, I've rebooted my computer 3 times and it's still happening. And I say, well, usually once is sufficient.
Well, thank you for taking a look at these computers, Tim.
It usually gets me out of it, too, but okay.
Well, don't worry, Tim. We will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I'm going to head over to the London Embassy for the 30th issue of Justice League Europe.
Water Podcast Network is a collection of super friends plus Shag. So what could be more appropriate than a podcast about the super friends? It's For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast, a read-through show about the classic DC comic book series covering all 47 issues of the original run plus a few surprises. Hosted by me, Rob Kelly, and a rotating group of my super friends. Coming soon from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
It all looks good to me.
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe, number 30. We're back from break, and I'm here with our second co-host for this episode. He is a returning guest to the show, and this time, he's in the proper embassy. Given that he's from England, hopefully the London embassy wasn't too far from home. He's also a massive Doctor Who fan that I've enjoyed talking with about the show, and he happens to be a pretty nice guy. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Dr. Chris Lewis. Welcome to the London embassy, Chris. Thanks for being here. How you been?
Shag, fancy bumping into you in London of all places. Look, just a little word to the wise. Probably best not to say your nickname out too loud in these parts. Folks will definitely get the wrong idea.
I can't tell you how many times I've been to a Doctor Who convention and I go to get an autograph and they say, would you like to make it out to you? I'm like, yes. And I tell them, please make it to Shag. And then they just stop. They like put down the pen. Peter Davison actually like lowered his glasses and looked at me over his glasses one time. Like, do you know what that means over in England? And Janet Fielding, who played Tegan, just gave me a hard time about it recently. So yeah, it's I understand. Yeah.
Maybe don't use the phrase making out and Shag in the same sentence either.
My brother-in-law is from England, and when I met him, he puts his hand out to shake my hand, and my sister tells him my name. He goes, oh, he goes by Shag, and he immediately pulls his hand back. Like, what? Oh, man.
It's a seabird. That's what it is.
Okay, I'll go with that. Very good. It's a dance over here, so. Or carpeting.
Okay, there we go. Okay.
Well, Chris, I am so glad you're here. This is super exciting. We've had a couple of chats now, one on a Justice League issue, one on Doctor Who. It's been a blast. Folks, if you want to hear Chris's origin with the JLI, you should go back to episode 39, Chris's first appearance on the show, where he got to tell us all about his love of the JLI. But Chris, this issue, as I understand, holds a special place in your heart. This is Justice League Europe number 30. Is that right?
That's right, Shay. So, you know, I've been listening to the shows and you're saying, oh, Breakdowns isn't terribly well received. And I cannot understand that, because this was exactly the time when I started getting into comics and buying comics regularly. And you know, when you get into a hobby and you are just completely in love with it, Breakdowns was absolutely in that sweet spot for me. And I would buy these things. They came out every fortnight because you get JLA, and then 2 weeks later you get JLE. And I love this series. It was such a good introduction to the DCU in general. And now I look back at it and go, they're really good at tying in all the old storylines. And we can, you know, we'll talk more about that as we get into the issue. But I love this issue. And I love this issue of JLE in particular. Not because it's set in the UK, because actually most of it is set in Byalia. But I think what it did to me is show me how well acted and emotional comics can be, not just the kind of, you know, wham, bam, pow, superhero thing, but there's such an emotional resonance to this comic, as we'll get on to. You know, it really got to me, and I was so in love with comics, and a lot of that I put down to Breakdowns in general.
That's fantastic. Now, folks, you've heard us talk on the show how Breakdowns has a reputation. If you're not listening to the feedback section of our show, I highly recommend it, because we've been getting lots of feedback on folks like you, Chris, that love Breakdowns. Now, there are some that explain their thoughts on why they think Breakdowns doesn't have a good reputation. So that's in there, too. So all that's being discussed in the feedback, which you should definitely be listening to. But here, what a great example of someone that loves the series. Now, I had that sort of negative sense, like, but it was just an echo, because I literally have not read these in 30 years. I have not read them in advance of recording the show. I've waited purposefully just so I could experience it as we go. I have not read beyond part 4 yet. So far, and I'm showing my hand because we talk about it at the end of the episode every time, but Breakdowns has been great. I mean, I've really enjoyed it. Now, we've got 10 more parts or 11 more parts to go, so maybe it starts to meander. I don't know. But up to this point, man, this thing's firing on all thrusters. It's really good. And you talk about the revisiting. You know, I sort of liken it to the ending of Return of the King, or, you know, Harry Potter revisiting every area in the last book, or David Tennant's Goodbye, where he goes and revisits everything from his entire era. That's what this is. They're hitting all the highlights of their whole era in this Breakdowns.
Yeah. I mean, I can sort of see it. I can sort of see it, because it does have a slightly more serious tone. It's slightly more superheroic than the blah, ha, 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 ha thing that's been going on for ages. And it is the end of an era. So I sort of see why people do have a, you know, maybe it doesn't quite tick all the boxes. But for me, it was, you know, just a great introduction to comics. And still love it. I used to go back and read the whole thing once a year, actually.
Oh, wow.
I haven't done for a while, but I did. Was that? That's how important it was.
That's really great. Then this is perfect to have you on. I'm so excited about this. Well, why don't we go ahead and get into it? So, folks, this is Justice League Europe number 30, published by DC Comics. Cover date is September 1991. On the shelves, August 6th, 1991. Probably hot, pretty hot when you're probably reading this. So, cover price is $1, four shiny quarters. Cover is by Derek Robertson and John Beattie. So, let's get into the cover. You want to describe it for us, Chris?
Sure. So this is one of those kind of classic comic covers where our heroes are represented as being really tiny, struggling against a supersized version of the villain, just to illustrate how vulnerable they are and completely at the mercy of their enemy. And we had it on that JL Quarterly cover with Mr. Nebula, where they're all kind of crawling all over him and falling through his fingers. But in this case, we have Elongated Man, Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, and Ice, who are trapped inside Jack Lantern's massive lantern. And attentive listeners will recognize those characters as the ones who have just got fired from their respective branches of the League. Now, I can't quite tell if they're sort of trying to stop Jack pushing the lid of the lantern down, or if they're trying to burst out, trying to escape. Either way, they are not happy with their predicament and this conflict. And worth saying, spoilers, there is no Godzilla-sized Jack-O-Lantern in this comic book. So this is an entirely metaphorical sense of powerlessness. There's no text on the cover other than the JLE masthead and the bit that says Breakdowns. There's no at the mercy of Jack-O-Lantern or anything like that. And it's dark. It's really black. It's a black background. There's lots of shadowing on Jack's mask and his gloves and his lantern. And that all adds a really somber and foreboding tone. And the heroes and the glowing eyes of the lantern are where are the bright spots on the cover. And that's where your eye gets drawn to. So it's a real feeling that our four jilted heroes are in genuine jeopardy here.
It's what a fantastic cover. I mean, this thing is gorgeous. I mean, artistically, Derek Robinson, all the figures look amazing. They really do. The mask, and we can come back to all that, but just things that jump out. Like you said, the color, the color was so clever to make the hero stand out, to make the glowing jack-o'-lantern eyes stand out. I love the poses of the heroes too, like Captain Atom struggling with all the strength to hold it up, Ice looking terrified as she's trying to push back on the lid.
Yeah.
You know, Ralph, of course, stretching his neck. But I just noticed Blue Beetle is not only reaching outside the jack-o'-lantern, he's actually got his fingers around the eye hole where the eye is. He's like, he's gripping the eye of the jack-o'-lantern and trying to pull himself out. I mean, it's, wow, so good.
It is really good. It's just beautifully drawn. And we'll talk a bit more about, I mean, the colorist should get a big shout out for this issue, I think. It's D'Angelo, isn't it? I think Gene D'Angelo. There are some bits in this, and the cover is an example of where the shadowing is just beautiful. And there's some really good examples of fantastic coloring in this issue as well. So yeah, shout out. Colorists don't get mentioned on covers, and I think they should sometimes.
Well, let me correct you, because I just looked in the back of the book, because I didn't know the colorist on the cover either. It's actually Bob LaRose, according to the credits in the back of the issue. So way to go, Bob LaRose. I mean, just expertly done. And a lot of that's Robertson too, though, because it's not just the color, it's the shading. Like, you know, Robertson in the inking are identifying where to ink for Beatty. They had to identify the shadows on Jack-o'-lantern's face. They had to identify that the lantern itself would be all in shadow except for the outline. So it's really a combination of the blacks and the color, and it just stands out. And it's great. And look at that mask. I mean, it's hard to draw somebody in just a cloth mask and make it not look silly.
Yeah.
And he just looks, without any facial expression, he looks super menacing.
I love this jack-o'-lantern costume. It's a bit better than the later ones. But that full face mask is just incredibly sinister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really well done. In fact, this cover is so good that when you look up jack-o'-lantern in Wikipedia, the character, this cover is the featured image in Wikipedia. That's how good it is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get inside, folks. So plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script by Gerard Jones, penciler is Derek Robertson, inker is John Beatty, letter is Willie Schubert, colorist is Gene D'Angelo, assistant editor is Kevin Dooley, and editor is Andy Helfer. The issue is called Breakdowns Part 4, The Widening Gyre, that word.
Yeah.
For some reason,
it's called that.
Right, exactly. You want to go ahead and do the first half of the issue, buddy?
Sure. Go, blimey, Governor. Strike a light. Here we are in the old smoke herself. And would you, Adam and Eve, it? Things are in a right 2-8. I ain't never seen anything like it in all my puff. It's enough to make an all sick. Even Auntie sent out some old act to report on the Justice League, or what used to be the Justice League, if you know what I mean. Everyone's having a right good butchers at the news on the telly. Even that element. No, Shag, this isn't working. I can't keep it up.
I really was afraid you were gonna, because I was gonna say, could you actually do it in American English, maybe? Rather than English?
Yes, everybody. So at the start of this issue, everyone is tuned into a news report from the dear old BBC, which conveniently recaps the major events of the last few issues, just in case you're joining us late. Meanwhile, in Byalia, Jack-o'-lantern, who isn't the Jack-o'-lantern from Super Friends, nor is he the Jack-o'-lantern from Primal Force, Jack-o'-lantern is explaining to Queen Bee that the recently released Captain Atom and his Interpol chaperone Inspector Camus have been killed, I'm doing air quotes, in a plane explosion. Though readers of JLA 54 and listeners to this very podcast will know that reports of their death have been greatly exaggerated. Queen Bee clearly does not listen to this podcast, and she believes that the captain and Camus have been killed. And she is, well, miffed. And when Queen Bee is miffed, heads will roll. She literally says heads will roll. What Jack gets out of this meeting is personal control over the Global Guardians. And as he flies away over the skyline of Byalia City, he soliloquizes about how he will take them as his own personal army and hand the kingdom of Byalia over to General Suman Harvati, double-crossing the Queen. What a duplicitous and unpleasant individual this jack-o'-lantern is. Cool costume, though. At Byalia International Airport, Revson CEO Vivian Daramis and her decidedly dodgy-looking entourage arrive as if on a business trip. However, we, of course, know her better as Crimson Fox, and the dubious group of personal assistants are the four laid-off members of JLI in their civilian identities. Ted Cord, Tora Olasdottir, Ralph Dibney, and the very much not dead Nathaniel Adam, all trying their very best to look incognito and failing spectacularly. The formerly known as the Justice Leaguers, ooh, that's a good idea for a title, step out of the airport and into the lion's den or the spider's web or the queen bee hive or something. I don't know. Interlude one. Behold the vast ethereal majesty of interstellar space, and hanging silently in the inky vacuum, nestled between the celestial orbs of unnamed planets, are the glistening porcelain white globes that house the omnipotent galactic trading organization recognized by sentient beings across the known universe as the Cluster. Within, Lord Manga Khan is in audience with a rather sappy-looking pot-bellied race of also unnamed aliens who are here to purchase a weapon which is described in less than savory terms as a world raper. My Lord Khan seems casually blasé about the promised demolition of an entire planet, when even his clients raise concerns about the unpredictable and uncontrollable aggression of the aforementioned weapon. I wonder who, what that weapon is. That, kids, is what we call foreshadowing. Manga Khan appeases the aliens by handing them what looks like a credit card, but is in fact a remote control device. Want to place odds on that going on the fritz in a couple of issues' time? Damn you, Khan.
Khan!
Oh, God.
That interlude was sponsored by the Manga Khan School of Melodrama for all your melodrama needs.
Interlude yeah, it was.
Back in the penthouse suite of Byalia's swankiest hotel, the I Can't Believe It's Not the Justice Leaguers are planning their next move. Beetle seems somewhat subdued, no doubt recalling his previous foray into Byalia when he was brainwashed by the Queen Bee and subsequently activated as a sleeper agent when he stabbed Oberon way back in Justice League America issue 26. Yes, Breakdowns is a masterclass in calling back to past storylines. For Ted, this mission has personal resonance. Ralph has been stretching through the ventilation shafts and conduits that crisscross the city, and based on his intel, the team decide to get out of the hotel via underground tunnels, which they believe were built on orders of the Queen Bee to enable her to kidnap people and whisk them away undetected for a nice quick brainwashing. Ted uses tech skills to disable the security systems and fox the Queen's listening devices, whilst Ralph stretches down a lift shaft to allow the others to climb down into the bowels of Byalia City. As they creep through the tunnels, Ted hypothesizes that for Max Lord's assassin to go undetected by the New York Embassy's own security systems, the assassin must have been metahuman. And where better to find metahumans in Byalia than the headquarters of the Global Guardians, the Dome? Interlude 2. The also very much not dead Inspector Camus is captured, blindfolded, and bundled into the office of Mr. Bigger. Now, you'll remember that he's the mysterious guy who's spying on the JLE through implants in Stinky the Cat. Mr. Bigger hands Camus an oldie-worldy VHS cassette. Do you remember those? I'm suddenly feeling very old. He says this tape contains evidence that the newly appointed JLI head honcho, Ambassador Heimlich, is a drone of da-da-da. Can we do the sound of shag? Can we? Huh?
No.
Well, it's the Queen Bee. Da, da, da. Camus is escorted away as unceremoniously as he arrived. Interlude ends. Back in the ductwork of Byalia City, our ex-leaguers away team have made it into the dome. Peering through a grill, they see a creepy sight. All the Global Guardians sitting at a U-shaped table. Dr. Mist, Bushmaster, Tuatara, Little Mermaid, Olympian, Godiva, Wild Huntsman, Rising Sun, all your favourites are here. Or are they? And what's creepy about them just sitting around a table? Well, every single one of them is frozen, completely stiff.
All right, I'll take it from here. And Chris used up all the good jokes already. I spent an enormous amount of time trying to come up with other formerly known as, and I can't believe it's not jokes, and I failed miserably. I had a whole slew of Justice League Elite, Justice League or Extreme Justice kind of jokes. None of them worked. So I'm just going to be a little more straightforward, folks. So here we go. The former Justice Leaguers exit the ductwork and enter the Global Guardians meeting room, surrounded by the eerily motionless Guardians. Captain Adam observes that it's almost like the Guardians have been turned off with a switch. The good captain also realizes that a vital member of the Guardians is missing, Jack-O-Lantern. Almost on cue, Jack-O-Lantern and Owlwoman enter the meeting room to find the former Justice Leaguers. Jack-O-Lantern seems pleased with this turn of events and relishes the idea of trouncing the heroes. Ice quickly freezes Owlwoman, removing her from the fight. Then Jack-O-Lantern blasts away at Crimson Fox, Ice, Ralph, and Ted. Captain Atom goes toe-to-toe against Jack-O-Lantern, but finds himself mostly on the defensive. Captain Atom blocks the powerful blast from Jack-O-Lantern, positioning himself to physically attack the foe. As Atom leaps, a stray blast from Jack-O-Lantern hits one of his own teammates. We can't be exactly sure the extent of the damage, as most of the gore is off-panel, but Jack-O-Lantern's powerful blast to the back of the head has killed the Global Guardian known as Little Mermaid. As everyone stands there horrified, Jack-O-Lantern casually transmits a radio message accusing the Justice League of murdering Little Mermaid. As the Leaguers are outraged by being framed, the rest of the Global Guardians awake and surround our heroes. Meanwhile, back in New York, Heimlich receives a call from the Queen Bee herself, which leads him to order the remaining Justice Leaguers to travel to Bealia to battle and neutralize their former friends, the ex-members of the Justice League. Dun-dun-dun! Next issue, Bealian Blues. Oof, man. Now, by the way, next month is next month, right? But I gotta mention, the next two issues are gonna be a doozy looking ahead. I haven't read them, but not only do we have breakdowns, right? But those breakdowns issues are gonna be covering tie-ins to both Armageddon 2001 and War of the Gods. Nothing like three crossovers going on in the same month, right?
Unfortunately, nothing happens with Captain Atom in Armageddon 2001. No, really, nothing happens.
No, that's Ted we talk about in Infinite Crisis. We can talk about Captain Atom Armageddon 2001. It's just wrong, but it's not what's supposed to happen. Oh, man. So, what'd you think of the issue, buddy?
Boy, what an amazing issue. Like I said at the start, I just love this issue. This is one of my favorite single issues of comics ever. And maybe it's just complete nostalgia. There's a lot of plot. Boy, it moves.
Yeah.
And it's just that tying together, bringing together so many threads, aren't they? You know, there's the whole story of Max's assassination, which, you know, is perhaps starting to peter out a little bit. But we've got Mr. Bigger coming in. We've got all these different layers of stories happening simultaneously. And, it, you know, they're bringing their entire history on this book all together in one. And it's a masterclass, I think, even though it's busy and there's a lot, it's pretty dense plot-wise.
Well, it really is. In the first half of the issue, I noticed this as it broke down because of our recaps. Like, the first half of the issue is very, very plot-heavy. And not in a bad way.
Yeah.
But just, it's a lot of development, a lot of stuff going on. And then the back half's pretty much just all one big fight. I mean, that's really all it is. Yeah. And that's okay, because that's what you want in a superhero comic, right? You want the subplot, you want the drama, then you want the fight. That's why we show up for, you know, spandex-clad superheroes. So I think it's really well put together as an individual issue and as part of the larger tapestry of Breakdown. So I'm right there with you. Again, we're showing our hand for how we're going to evaluate at the end, but this was great.
Yeah. I think you can see that perhaps the humor does get squeezed out a little bit if I'm being super critical, but you know, it's not that it's not a funny comic because it still is. It's just not the kind of laugh out loud, you know, cooey type issues that we've had in the past. But, you know, I'm all up for this comic book. Thank you for asking me to do it.
Well, if you think about it, though, Justice League Europe was always supposed to be the more serious of the two anyway. So this one's sort of, it's sort of fitting that this one has the gasp, the shock, the horror, more so than Justice League America might.
Yeah. They're merging a little, aren't they? I think, you know, we've got a sort of, our away team here is 50% JLA, 50%. Actually, if we slightly more JLE biased, if we include Crimson Fox, although she's a bit of a minor player, I think, in this team, as it sort of focuses around those main four who've got the boot from the main league. But it's great. It's just such a cracking comic and absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, Derek Robertson's art. Wow. So this is what his, I've kind of lost track. I think this is his third comic we've covered now between the quarterly, the previous issue of Breakdowns, and this. I mean, for a guy who was so new to the industry, this issue looks great. It's absolutely beautiful.
his facial expressions and his facial acting are just stunning. You know, the page three, the queen bee, who is really furious. There's an amazing close-up on her eyes. I mean, it's not quite photorealistic, but it's amazingly good. The dynamic sequences with Jack-o'-lantern flying through the air. Yeah, just incredible.
Before you go further, I just want to talk about that. So one of the things that really blew me away about this book was the panel design. So like he does a really, really great job with panel design. It varies. He keeps it. I mean, we know Giffen did the layouts, right? But here, Robertson has told us, he told us on Twitter that he had a lot of freedom to do what he wanted. So here he's obviously playing with the panel design. You specifically mentioned page four, where Jack-o'-lantern's flying.
Yeah.
If you look, it's just, it's not anything revolutionary. It's just three panels across the top, a large panel, and the two panels at the bottom. But he's using the environment to make it more interesting. He's got Jack-o'-lantern's cape breaking the panel borders above it. I mean, he does a lot of that where there's a lot of panel border breaking to make things interesting, like on page four. Go to page 14. This one in particular is just a page that I thought was phenomenal. So what's going on page 14 here? It's a super straightforward page. And I'm sure Giffen just drew six regular tall, skinny panels, three on the top, three on the bottom, right? But what Robertson has done is he's taken these panels and he's made them exceptional. By the panels vary in size just slightly. They actually overlap. You can see the panel borders overlapping each other. One of the panels is all silhouette. And then the final panel is this shot of Jack-o'-lantern, and he's huge. It's a huge close-up of him. He's breaking through the panel borders across one, two, three different panels. And of course, the artistry. He's got this really... We talked earlier about how the mask and how Robertson is a master at making that mask look... It's just a piece of cloth, but it looks so sinister. That's the most dangerous smile I've ever seen coming through that mask. Like that page is so simple, and yet it's like you could teach a class on how to lay out a page from that page.
I mean, we should say there's really clever use of silhouette, and they use silhouette with the black and then this very sort of lantern light type yellow behind it to illustrate, and they do that all the way through the book. It's like a fingerprint. But then to that image of Jack-o'-lantern at the bottom, you know, they're doing that whole Spider-Man eyes thing where, you know, it's his cloth mask, but he uses the eyes changing shape and size to express emotion. But he has that cloth mask sucked onto the guy's face like it's vacuum packed. And that means you can still pick up, you know, details of the nose and details of the smile. And although they're not there, they are covered by the mask. There's just enough to give those hints. It's really creepy and it's brilliantly done. And I can't think of anywhere I've seen it done as well as this. And this is the guy's third published comic book. Oh my God. You know, it's amazing. Really good stuff. Love it.
And knocking it out of the park right from the start. Just such a great talent. So wonderful. Yeah. Amazing stuff.
And it would go through to Transmetropolitan was the book I knew him from next. It wasn't really a boys reader, but Transmetropolitan, you can just see his style evolving. On that point, there is one downside, and that is hairstyles. There are some hairstyles are fine, but others are not good. When Jack takes his mask off, he looks a bit like Marge Simpson crossed with a hedgehog.
I've got a better one, and it's a British reference. Maybe you'll get it. Find a page with Jack-o'-lantern. I think page three or something's probably a good one early on, and take a look at page three and tell me. That doesn't look like Del Tarrant from Blake 7.
Oh, there we go. It does look like Del Tarrant. There's a niche reference.
Yeah, sorry. I couldn't unsee it once I saw it. So, but yeah, some of the other haircuts, like, you know, Captain Atom on page 13, when they're just before they fight the Global Guardians, it's a pretty generic haircut for the captain. I mean, we've seen a lot of haircuts for him, whether it's buzz cuts or the long kind of like almost like a mullet and things like that. This one doesn't really cut the mustard, but you know what? It's a small nitpick, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Maybe that's why Spider Jerusalem in Transmetropolitan was bald the whole way through.
That's why he draws masks on everyone, right?
So I have no idea why this book is called The Widening Gyre, because that relates to ocean currents. And there's nothing about that in here. So that's a bit odd. The BBC reporter on page one is drawn in a very specific way. And it did make me go, I wonder if this is a real person, but I cannot think of any 1980s, 1990s BBC reporter that looks like this. Is it an American reporter, Shag? Does that face ring a bell to you?
I felt the same as you. Like, there's a lot of faces in here that there was a lot of time and effort put into background characters to make me think, okay, maybe he based that on somebody. Because you're right, this looks like it's got to be based on somebody, but I don't have a clue. But I mean, that haircut, the mustache, the shape of the face, it looks like a real person. So it's not a knock at who he's illustrated. It's just, we just don't know them. But man, that looks like a real person. It absolutely does. And I do think the news catch-ups were done very effectively because it helps get you back up to speed on what's going on. And some folks may not be reading Justice League America, because think about it. Back then, people were still getting subscriptions.
Yeah.
And if you were subscribed to Justice League Europe, you weren't getting the America half of the story. And so this was an effective way to get that information.
Yeah. No, it's a really clever device to do that. Speaking of very specific looks, I want to talk about the aliens that Manga Khan is dealing with, because they've got a very particular look. They've got very long, drawn faces with very big black eyes and sort of these very protruding pot bellies. And they don't look familiar to me in any way, but they look like they ought to. And I wondered, am I missing a reference there? Is there a DC alien race that looks like this?
I couldn't come up with anything specific either, but my instinct tells me that they reminds me a lot of various aliens you would see throughout Steve Rude and Mike Barron's Nexus. I love that comic. Mm. It's an amazing book. And the face, the long sort of horse-like face, the weird neck and all that, it reminds me a lot of some Nexus aliens. I flipped through my Nexus omnibus. It's just in preparation. I didn't find a specific one to go, ooh, it's that one. But there is sort of a general sense of a lot of aliens do kind of have that sort of big bulbous black eyes and stuff. So I don't know whether it's a nod to Nexus or not, but that's what I felt like. Otherwise, it's a cool-looking alien.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they get a very small bit part, but they've got a lot of design for something that's, you know, for a race that pops in and pops out and has no other real relevance to the story, at least not yet anyway.
Well, he does this a lot. I mean, like even at the airport, there's characters in the background that have been fully designed. Like one guy in the airport background, he's got a giant like Elvis Presley pompadour haircut. Like he put the effort into showing that. So again, if he's either drawing friends or he's just really that much of an attention to detail, which is great.
Oh, that's interesting, because I read that as a bloke with a turban on.
Well, there is a guy with a turban on the second panel, but the third panel...
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Sorry, we're looking at different panels. Yeah, okay.
He's even got a Joker t-shirt on.
He has, yeah.
So I didn't know whether he was, you know, drawing himself or drawing a friend or just having fun. So either way...
He does have that look of sneaking a friend in the background, doesn't he?
Yeah. But he puts a lot of attention to detail, which I love. Mm. It makes it feel like a more robust world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One more thing on that page. And again, it's the silly stuff that makes me happy. And part of it's because I read this stuff on panel by panel mode over on Comixology when I bought these a long time ago. But if you look on page 5, again, same page where they're at the airport, the second panel, Ice, first of all, everyone's dressed in business suits, by the way. Everyone's dressed in business attire. But Ice has got glasses on and she is studying some document very closely. Like she's reading an itinerary or something. And I love the idea of their, first of all, incognito. Second of all, that does feel like something Ice would do. Like she's going to be prepared for the meeting that they're about to have, right? You know, I mean, she's going to know the agenda. It's sort of fitting. And I just, the small little touches like that, you know, I'm sure we're not in the breakdowns, no pun intended. I'm sure it was not in what Giffen provided. And I just love that he adds little touches like that.
Yeah. And she's wearing glasses, which obviously she doesn't usually do, but she's sort of got a hand to her glasses, almost like I'm trying to partially cover my face a little bit. It just all fits with the Captain Atom and Beetle, who has a terrible mustache, by the way.
I think he wore a terrible mustache when he came to Bialya before, too, if I remember right.
Oh, did he? Okay. Oh, well, perhaps he would have been better not wearing it. Anyway, but they've definitely got the sort of security guard heavy kind of look, whereas Ice has much more the demure secretary look to her, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She does.
I want to talk about our little away team, because although these are perhaps not the most highly powered heroes in the league, they work so well as a little unit. Everybody gets their moment to shine. Ted has brought his gadgets and his gizmos and his, you know, playing back pre-recorded conversations to the bugs in the room, and he's using his talents to fox the security systems. Ralph pops up through some grating because he's been exploring. He's been using both his stretching and his sleuthing skills to try and figure things out. Ice uses her powers in a really fantastic and quite offensive as opposed to defensive way. I think often she's quite a, you know, she'll throw up a shield of ice to protect people. But she definitely takes Owl Woman out in one fell swoop in this. It's really good, and they're functional, and they communicate. You know, Captain Atom's a much more confident leader with these guys than he is in previous episodes of JLE, where he's always doubting, always second-guessing, always a bit underconfident about what's going on. If they functioned this well in the previous issues, they might not have got thrown off the team.
Well, you mentioned Ice. I mean, let's point out, she throws the first punch. Like, the fight starts there. The fight doesn't even start. They're just facing each other. They're still taunting each other. And wham, she is frozen out. Like, they even, it's all happens off panel, which is done so cool. You just see Owl Woman in a block of ice. And like, what? Oh my gosh, ice, you know, ice went first, which is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it's that freezing. Jack then goes, so you want it the hard way, and starts firing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's definitely an act of aggression, which I don't personally think of it as being part of that ice character, but it absolutely fits. It's terrific, this little group. Again, it's just them working incredibly well together. And love it. Really good, that little sequence. Like you say, it is a big fight, but, you know, there's real good evidence of them functioning as a team.
Yeah. So one of the things I like about this little combination of characters is that it brings a little bit of what I enjoy about the difference in the teams, which is you've got three people from Justice League Europe and two people from Justice League America. And you notice Ice and Beetle both specifically go by Ice and Beetle. They're superhero names. You know, Crimson Fox, they don't really call her Crimson Fox. They call her, D'Aramis, her last name in here. Ralph, of course, goes by Ralph, not Elongated Man. Captain Atom sort of sits in the world in between because he was on Justice League America for a long time. So when he came over to Europe, he still uses the name Captain Atom rather than Nathan or Nate. But I love that the Justice League Europe people always go by the real name, whereas America goes by the superhero names. It sort of demonstrates that Europe is more of a family and America's more of a working relationship. And you see a little bit of that still in the group. But I agree, they do function really well together as a unit. I mean, they could be almost, if you throw Metamorpho on here, they would have been a great espionage team because he's got all the espionage powers too. It's a really good group. I agree.
And I do like the fight. I think it does feel quite scrappy and quite dangerous. There's a lot of blasts coming out from Jack, and they're having to duck and dive, and there's debris falling around the place. So and he really pins Captain Atom down in that final kind of sequence before it all goes wrong. I like it as a fight.
Well, one of the things to note too, really, you know, we mentioned Ice freezing Owl Woman, which is awesome, but beyond that, Captain Atom really is the star of the fight. Like, Beetle and Crimson Fox and Elongated Man, they're like helping Owl Woman and jumping around, but they don't really do anything. And that's okay. I mean, from the writing perspective, they're clearing the deck so to get to what's important in the fight, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of thought maybe Beetle or Fox or Elongated Man would do something clever, or Ice might at least try and take another blast, but they literally do nothing. I had to go back and look. They don't do anything the rest of the fight, which is sort of weird. But let's talk about the big thing here in the room, you know, or the lack of, oh my gosh, murdering Little Mermaid. Wow. Now, this is 1991. So maybe Disney slapped him with an injunction for using the name Little Mermaid. I don't know. But it's just the
right... Did they have a film coming out?
Already did by this point, but yeah. So there's... There's just enough gore. I mean, it happens off panel. She gets hit in the back of the head. You can tell that. You don't actually see the strike. And then later on, you don't see the body. You just see blood all over the table, and her head is... Or her shoulders are slumped over. But I got to assume he blew a hole right through her head. It's got to be what happened.
Well... We do have the glorious sound effect splatch, which gives you a bit of a clue as to what's going on. But it is the next page. It is page 19. And it's almost a silent page, you know, for three quarters of it. It's a silent page. And all you get are these absolutely stunningly rendered reaction shots. Captain Atom is looking backwards over his shoulder to see what's happened. We have Crimson Fox holding a hand to her face. We've got Ted, who is clearly disgusted. Ralph is shocked. And Ice, we have tears running down her face because this was a former teammate of hers. And she is just distraught. And she very quietly, in those brilliant word balloons that just have very small writing, a lot of white space and very small writing, she just says Ulla, the name of the character. And it's a heart-stopping page. It's beautifully done. And it is so well drawn. It's so well acted by these characters. Again, you know, I think this is why I'd hold it up as one of my favorite single issues and just go, if you can get that much emotional reaction out of your reader, then you're doing something really, really right. And then we get Jack saying, oh, the Justice League has killed the Global Guardian. And it does make me go, well, who was at fault here? You know, was it Jack for launching the bolt, or was it Captain Atom for jumping out of the way without really knowing? It's a bit of a hand shot first moment.
Okay. Well, because also the Justice League are the ones that chose to break into the dome, you know, so they are partially responsible for Little Mermaid's death. By the way, as a Star Wars fan, I have to correct you. There is no such thing as Han shot first. There's Han shot only. So just want to point that out. But
okay.
So it's, sorry, being a bit pedantic, but we're here to talk about comics from 30 years ago. I'm allowed to be. So Little Mermaid's an interesting choice because they could have killed any of the characters, right? But because she's the younger one and she's female, I guess maybe they're hoping for a little bit of fridging, you know, the concept of the young woman who dies to push the story forward. But it's also interesting they chose her because she was responsible for a key part of the Global Guardian subplot. Because in the previous appearances, she was the one that kept shaking off the Global Guardian's conditioning. She's the one who realized, wait, something's not right. And they kept having to re-brainwash her. So I don't know whether that was a purposeful choice because of that reconditioning issue or because, again, they were just trying to do a fridging kind of concept. I mean, before the term existed, but trying to do that. Mm. But either way, it's an interesting choice. Yeah. It's sad. It's heartbreaking. It really is. And that page 19, you've already said it, but wow. Just the combination of the facial expressions and then that darkness of Jack-O-Lantern framing them. It's just like you go from equally horrified with the team to yourself as the reader being outraged that they're going to take the heat for this.
And Jack as the Queen Bee's puppet, maybe she's not too sorry to see Little Mermaid go if she's the troublesome one in the Global Guardians group. So using her death in this way might be, you know, might be something that Jack and Queen Bee slightly welcome. So, emotionally manipulated on every level I am on this page.
So you mentioned the Queen Bee. So let me ask a question there. So she's being framed by Harjavati for the murder of Maxwell, or for the shooting of Maxwell Lord, and Jack-O-Lantern's, you know, involved in all this. Are we supposed to feel sorry for her? I mean, she's a horrible person. You know, if a few bad guys take each other out, is that really the worst thing to ever happen?
Oh, dear. What a shame. Never mind. Well, yeah. I mean... There's nobody good in this whole situation, is there? You know, they're all trying to manipulate one another. So, yeah, I can't say I do feel a whole lot of sympathy for the Queen Bee. So,
right,
maybe she'll get her just desserts.
I haven't read ahead, so I don't know anything. I'm
not saying nothing.
All right. So what else you got on the issue, buddy?
I think we've kind of said it already, but just how good is this issue at doing all the callbacks? You know, they go back to, you know, you've said all the Justice League Europe stuff about Little Mermaid being resistant. We're going to come on to the identity of Jack-O-Lantern, which is something that comes through really early JLE issues. We've got the Ted Kord being mind wiped story from, you know, the sort of second year of JLA. We've got Manga Khan coming in. We've got Mr. Bigger coming in. They are doing such a bang up job of bringing all these threads together. Just, you know, masterful stuff. And it just makes the whole run like a coherent story, not issue by issue by issue. It just ties the whole thing up so beautifully. And I'm blown away by that.
So I do wonder, for a new reader, does it make it impenetrable with all the callbacks, or have they done such a good enough job that people just read and pick up on what's going on? Now, I like to give readers a lot of credit. For example, like I myself became a DC Comics reader beginning with Crisis on Infinite Earths number 6 and 8. So I was able to figure that. I mean, if you can make your way through the middle of Crisis and figure out the DC universe, then I think anyone can figure out anything. So yeah. I don't want to sell anyone short. And I also can't look at this impartially because I am too steeped in the knowledge. So I don't know. Any gut instinct on whether it's impenetrable or, you know, there's enough here.
I think that it is not impenetrable because this was one of my very first, very early comics.
Oh, that's right.
I was slightly confused whether Captain Atom was anything to do with the Atom because I hadn't heard of Captain Atom before. And I certainly wasn't aware of all the other stuff going on. As you've mentioned already, you know, Armageddon 2001 was going on at the same time. And that was really good because that really did bring every hero. And I've kind of go, who are these? The Titans. Who are these people? So that was a really good DCU primer for me. But I could get into this quite easy. And I think because it hits on that emotional level, you get the response to it, even if you kind of go, I'm not totally sure who all these people are, but it's that good that these, you can see what's going on. You know, you can feel the emotional immensity of the events in this comic. And I think that's a hook. So for me, yeah, no, absolutely not a barrier.
You just made me think of something too, is you're reading the superhero comic, you're just meeting these characters for the first time, let's say, and they're not even in their costumes. You know, they're just wearing business suits, which by the way, look great. Yeah. The heroes in the business suits look great, but it's enough. Each character is enough of a distinction. You know, Captain Adam's got the white hair, Ted's got the brown hair, Ralph's got the red hair, you know, Ice has got white hair, and Crimson Fox has got kind of reddish hair. So it works that way. Everyone looks individual. You never get mixed up who these characters are. And his artistry is so good that they all have different body types. So, it's right there on the page. Between the art and the story, you're right. They do make it approachable. Now, you mentioned Ted Kord. I gotta have one complaint. And I don't know whether I'm fussing at the scripter or I'm fussing at the letterer. I don't know. But he mentions his name. He says, well, I was Ted Kord. And they spell it with a C. Kord with a C. Ted Kord? Come on. Shame. Shame.
Don't get tied up in the detail, Shaq. Cut the cord and let it free.
It's cutting the cord with a K. Thank you very much. So you mentioned Mr. Biggers as well. So I got a question. So Inspector Camus is pulled in by Mr. Biggers in here, right? And that's an effective way to make sure that we as the reader understand that Heimlich is working for Queen Bee. We suspected it. You know, it's been pretty sure, but this confirms it for us, right? So that Heimlich's working for Queen Bee. How did Mr. Biggers know that Inspector Camus was alive? Because the world thinks he's dead right now. And last I heard, he was like hiding out in the Revson offices of Crimson Fox. So I'm fine that they got him, but that is one part I would say that they're missing in the script to explain how they found him or how they knew he was alive or some. I feel like there should have been, even if it's just one sentence, something should have explained how they knew Camus was alive.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they don't. Maybe Stinky isn't the only cat they have implants in. maybe Revson has an office cat.
Okay.
You know, can I get a no prize for that?
Or, wrong company, but sure.
You know, he might step out of the offices to, you know, go and buy a newspaper or something and they pick him up off the street. I don't know. But yeah, I agree. They're just a very powerful, shadowy organization. They can find their man if they need to.
I suppose. All right. So stepping back, I mean, we're wrapping up the issue here. Kind of the scorecard is we know Heimlich is working for the Queen Bee directly now. Got it. We know General Havarti, the brother, is framing the Queen Bee, and she's hoping that the Justice League is going to take her out so that he can control Bealia. Got that. Jack-O-Lantern's clearly working for General Havarti. He's a double agent. He's not really working for the Queen Bee, even though she thinks she is. So he's working for Havarti, but he might be plotting against Havarti as well. Got it. So unless I have forgotten something, I don't think we still know yet who shot Max. I mean, the hints are that Havarti ordered it, maybe. Maybe it was Jack-O-Lantern, but I don't think we still yet know who shot Max.
I agree. I don't think we do know. Maybe the Queen Bee ordered it as well, would be somebody on there, but still a bit of a mystery.
Well, I don't think the Queen Bee did it, because I think they made it a couple of issues ago pretty clear that Havarti's trying to frame the Queen Bee so that the Justice League will take her out for him. He's basically manipulating the Justice League, which is interesting. You'd think that taking out the Queen Bee would be easier than killing the Justice League, but apparently that's Havarti's plan, is go after the tougher group to get them to take out the Queen Bee. I don't know.
Okay, so we've got the Queen Bee through Jack trying to manipulate the Global Guardians, and we've got Havarti trying to manipulate the Justice League. So it sounds like we're going to get a face-off soon.
I hope so. We'll find out soon. I haven't read it yet, so I don't know. And it sounds like there was a pun hidden in there that I don't get, but that's okay. A lot of things go over my head. All right, so folks, we are going to now step out of the issue and talk a little bit more on the characters and something I like to call the
Character Spotlight.
We haven't done one of these in a while because we've done pretty much every character, but this is a great opportunity where Chris is going to tell us a little bit about one of the featured characters of this issue, Jack-O-Lantern. Why don't you tell us about that character?
So, Shag, we were saying 2 years ago, it's almost exactly 2 years that I came on this show and you asked me to do a character spotlight on Lord Havok. And so I read every comic book appearance of Lord Havok in order to prepare for that. And now you ask me with 4 days notice to do Jack-O-Lantern.
First of all, I would never ask anyone to read every comic of Lord Havok because I know the road of madness that leads down. Okay. Especially post-crisis or after later down the road. I would never do that. You took that upon yourself. I did not ask you to read. You could have just gone to Wikipedia and copied the entry, man. It's not that hard of an assignment.
So for 4 days, Shag, I've been reading every appearance of Jack-O-Lantern. So all I want to ask is, why do you hate me? And what have I done to you to deserve such cruelty?
Well, remember that spreadsheet you used to keep up with about who won the Bwahaha Award? Once you stopped keeping up the spreadsheet, it became my personal mission to make your life miserable.
I need to get back on that, but we have had a little pandemic to keep me busy. So, okay. Folks, I've read quite a lot of Jack-O-Lantern comics in the last 4 days, so you owe me one, okay? Jack-O-Lantern. Jack-O-Lantern is the alter ego used by 3 characters in the DCU, and all of them have come into possession of a mystical lantern, which may or may not be created out of a pumpkin. There's quite a lot of uncertainty around Jack-O-Lantern generally. And this lantern has been juiced up by a leprechaun queen, giving the bearer powers of flight, flame projection, teleportation, illusion casting, enhanced strength, and the ability to create mystical fog. That Ooh. Is one heck of an exceptional pumpkin.
Mystic fog.
Yeah, who doesn't love a bit of mystic fog? So the first Jack-O-Lantern, the original, was Daniel Cormack, who was a member of the Global Guardians representing Ireland and was created by E. Nelson Bridwell and Ramona Fraiden. And Daniel was born to a poor farmer who was granted a magic lantern by an Irish fairy called Fergus. Jimmy McGlinchey of the Irish Embassy, I can only apologize for this appalling national stereotyping. It was a different time, but that doesn't make it okay. And as a member of the Global Guardians, Cormac's first story was Super Friends number 8, where he was helping Green Lantern to dismantle a bomb. And he then appears in 3 solo backup 8-page stories in Super Friends 37, 40, and 44. And you can go and listen to that on Rob's podcast, For All Mankind, which I've also been on recently. Thank you, Rob. But just as a spoiler, those little stories, they're not great stories. And so his first appearance in continuity, because Super Friends was not in continuity, was the mainstream DC Comics Presents number 46, which was also E. Nelson Bridwell and an artist called Alex Soviak. I'm not familiar with Alex Soviak, so I looked him up and apparently he was mostly a Marvel Spider-Man artist, but do you know more?
Well, he did quite a bit of DC Comics Presents stuff, whether it's like the backups of Whatever Happened To, stuff like that as well. But yeah, he is mainly known as a Spider-Man artist. He was a great sort of traditional superheroic artist. I love his work. So it's always nice to see him back in the fold doing stuff that we love.
Great. I mean, it was a terrific comic for a number of reasons. Firstly, it features the Fire and Water Network's favorite new hero, 1980s, The Seraph. Have you heard of The Seraph before, Shag? He's great. His backup stories in Super Friends have been amazingly good. And I learned more about the Global Guardians in this single book than all their JLI appearances put together. It was a real primer for Global Guardians. But I do have to say that Jack-O-Lantern was written very Irish stereotypical again. Abigora, to be sure, nope, still not okay. So Jack-O-Lantern then was in Crisis on Infinite Earths as part of a group of heroes from Ireland and England trying to save the world because appearing in Crisis on Infinite Earths was a contractual obligation in 1985. And then we start, after Crisis, we get into the politics of it a bit. So it was revealed that the Global Guardians had been brought together by Dr. Mist to serve as the enforcing arm of an international organization called the Dome, which apparently was created in the Treaty of Rome in 1957 to organize the efforts of superheroes around the globe as an international police organization. And the Global Guardians were based in a UN-financed headquarters building, which confusingly was also called the Dome, and that was located in Paris. And that will be very familiar from earlier episodes of this podcast. And eventually, the Guardians lost their UN funding to the Justice League, and the Dome was ordered to close. Some of the members left the team to join the League, notably Fire and Ice, but other heroes went freelance, joining with General Ruman Havati's so-called New Dome in Byalia. And after the JLE's first incursion into Byalia in JLE number 4, we were led to believe that Daniel is killed by the Queen Bee, and she puts in a new man to take up the title of Jack-o'-lantern. Put a pin in that. We're going to come back.
The sad part is, clearly we covered those issues in the show, and I don't even remember Jack-o'-lantern being killed. I don't remember anything about it. I understand that, but until your recap, I didn't even realize this was a different Jack-o'-lantern. So please continue.
Yeah. I have to say, this took a bit of teasing out as to the exact timeline and who was who where. Good news is Daniel wasn't actually killed, and we pick up his story in Justice League Quarterly, issues 6-8, where he's found alive in the sewers by his girlfriend, Owl Woman, and then they join up with Dr. Mist and they reunite the Global Guardians in further issues of Justice League Quarterly. But unfortunately, they get in with the wrong crowd yet again, and they fight alongside Sonar against the Justice League in Justice League Europe issues 49 and 50, which is probably the best JLE story of the post-Giffen and DeMatteis era. And sometime afterwards, and I think this is probably an issue of Primal Force, we're told that Daniel Cormack dies of natural causes. Given that he could have been devoured by an evil pumpkin avatar or torn limb from limb by resentful Irish fairies, perhaps that is somewhat refreshing. So that's Jack-o'-lantern number one. Jack-o'-lantern number two was Marvin Noronsa, weird name. And that was the new man who briefly took over the mantle as the second Jack-o'-lantern, as an agent of the Queen Bee. And this is the character we're seeing in this issue of JLE. And by the evidence of this comic book, he is in possession of the single worst haircut in all of creation. And perhaps that explains why he's become a villain.
Okay. Makes sense. The Del Tarrant is a haircut to avoid.
There we go. So the villainous version of Jack joins forces with Queen Bee, and he's basically the bruiser behind her schemes. But as we heard in this issue, he attempts to double cross her with Ruman's twin brother, Suman, in order for him to oust the Queen and take over control of Byalia for himself. And so no more spoilers. Stay tuned to see how that plan goes. Hint, not great. And apparently, Marvin Noronsa is a recurring villain in the series Powerless. And that is was that a sitcom? I think we didn't get it over here. Was that the DC sitcom I think you've spoken about?
Yes, it was a sitcom that was about it took place in the DC universe, but it was about I think it was a marketing or agency or I can't remember exactly what their jobs were, but they were regular people working in the DC universe. So there was lots of funny bits about weird science experiments and then trying to rebrand characters. There was a lot of business jokes. Like, it was run by one of Bruce Wayne's cousins. Crimson Fox was a sort of reoccurring character. Fire was in it as well. It was like, universally, no one liked it when it aired. Let's put it that way. However, I didn't watch it when it aired. I watched it later in binging and found that I love it. I mean, the series is genuinely charming. It's goofy. It's silly. I don't even remember this character being in it. Jack-o'-lantern, I have to go back and look and rewatch it. But it's a fun show and deserves a second look.
Okay. So apparently he was portrayed by an actor called Kimani Ray Smith, who I'm not familiar with. And then we have the third Jack-o'-lantern, who is Liam McHugh, who took the name on. He was an Irish freedom fighter. We meet in the post-Zero Hour series Primal Force. Liam is Daniel McCormack's nephew, and he's a good guy. He carries the lantern throughout the run of Primal Force, but there's a suggestion that at some later point, he's internalized the lantern's powers. Don't know how. Probably best not to ask. Maybe he ate the pumpkin. And after Primal Force disbanded, he joins the Ultra Marine Corps in JLA 26 and JLA Classified 1 to 3. But that Morrison stuff kind of leaves me a bit cold. So, Shag, let's talk Primal Force because I think we're fans.
Oh, I love that series. Now, I haven't reread it since it originally ran. I've always had this intention to get to it. I haven't done it, but I love this series. I love seeing Jack-O-Lantern as a protagonist. Not the greatest costume in the world in there. If I remember, it was just like a cut-off cloth sack, essentially, is what he's wearing, right?
Burlap sack.
Yeah.
Turnip, I think.
Yeah. not the best look, but the character was great. He seemed to be true-hearted. He wanted to do the right thing. It was a cool idea, the way they used the lantern, the other characters were... Because JLI, I love rooting for the underdogs, right? So that series was a lot of fun. I think it had a lot of potential. And great writing, game. Steven Siegel. The artist was really good. I can't remember. It's slipping away from my head at the moment. But yeah, I loved Primal Force. You did as well, it sounds like?
Yeah, I did, yeah. It was another one of those sort of 90s teams kind of books. Terrific Red Tornado. I know those words don't often get used together, but you get this sort of slightly malfunctioning Red Tornado who's, goes a little bit into the air elemental thing at the end, which I'm less fond of. But yeah, it was sort of part of the rehabilitation of Red Tornado, who then went into Young Justice and was kind of the mentor to that team. So yeah, I thought it was great. Be an interesting one to cover at some point, I think, because there was, I think it's a bit of a forgotten gem, personally.
Well, it really is. And they threw together some really interesting sort of characters. Again, it's Jack-O-Lantern, it's Red Tornado, who's, if I remember right, isn't this the one where he doesn't talk? Is that right?
For quite a lot of the book, yeah.
And when he does talk...
Sort of clanks some words.
And if I remember right, maybe I'm getting my series mixed up, but when he does talk, I want to say it's quotes from old Justice League comics, if I remember right, but I might have that mixed up with something else. Either way, you've got Red Tornado, you've got a weird Jack-O-Lantern, you've got, what is it, the Claw from the old, yeah, from the old, like 70s comics. Yep. You've got a Gollum character.
Gollum.
Who is essentially the Gollum from Ragman, but not exactly the same Gollum. Then you've got a new character called Meridian. And then later on, they bring in Black Condor. I mean, it was a lot of fun. Ken Hooper, by the way, was the name of the artist. I couldn't remember earlier. And Dr. Mist was sort of tied in with it a bit as well. So it's a fun book that tried to do magic. It's sort of like a proto Shadow Pack. It's kind of what it is.
Yes, that's it.
Take a bunch of underdog existing characters and talk about it. And I enjoyed the book.
Me too. I think revisit worth a revisit at some point, I think.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about Jack-O-Lantern for a second here, because like for me as a kid, I had a really hard time distinguishing between Green Lantern and Jack-O-Lantern. All right. Now, I mean, not visually, sure, I could tell. Right. But beyond the visuals, there's a lot of similarities, obviously. Right. And both of them, and here's where the big difficulty came for me, is both of them appeared in Who's Who number 9, which was my first ever issue of Who's Who. And if I don't know if everyone else was like me, but I was just the right age. Who's Who was such an eye-opener for me, and that was the only issue I owned, so I read it over and over and over and over. So I put way too much focus on minor characters like Jack-O-Lantern. And, you know, this whole issue of Who's Who is packed with all this variety of Green Lanterns. And then here's this Jack-O-Lantern character, right? And he's on the cover.
Yeah.
He's next to John Stewart. He's wearing green. He's carrying a lantern. So in my head, I'm like, maybe it's just an alternate version of a Green Lantern. And there's not actually a lot of information about Jack in the Who's Who. It's only the Global Guardians entry. But there's a decent-sized write-up in Jeff Rovin's Encyclopedia of Superheroes. I don't know if you've ever seen this book or not. It was published in 85. It's a big, thick, almost like coffee table-sized book. But it's an Encyclopedia of Superheroes. It's essentially Who's Who, but in text format. But it covers every company of comics ever. And I read this thing religiously. Basically, I'd read the Who's Who entry, and then I'd read the Jeff Rovin Encyclopedia, his superheroes entries for characters. Mm-hmm. So I read the entry on Jack-O-Lantern. And yeah, they both got a lot of powers, a variety of powers. They both get it from their magic lantern. The magic lantern needs recharging. They both could fly. The lantern, you know, they both wear green. Hopefully you could see my dilemma. So I was a bit confused.
Yeah. I forgot to say something in my recap, actually. The Jack-O-Lantern lantern is most powerful at midnight and least powerful at midday. midday because the lantern has least effect at midday. And I quite like that. That was quite a novel kind of weakness to have. So, yeah, but I absolutely see, you know, it's kind of who's lantern number nine, isn't it? Rather than who's who. Definite similarities between the characters. Less sort of ring construct type stuff. It's more of a force of power, isn't it? The jack-o'-lantern lantern. But yeah, I can definitely see why 9-year-old Shag was a bit confused by that.
Well, thank you so much for the character spotlight on Jack-o'-lantern. That was fascinating. Again, I didn't even know half the stuff until reading your document, preparing for this. So you've opened my eyes. And I'm glad to know our beloved Jack-o'-lantern from Super Friends and Primal Force is not the same guy. So that's good to know.
No.
Now, as we do in every Breakdowns issue, I got to ask you, you know, your feelings on this. Because Breakdowns, again, has this reputation for being very divisive, right? Some people love it. A lot of people don't. And we've heard in the comments, again, in the feedback section, people's feelings on either why they didn't like it or maybe it's a speculation. So for you, personally, does this, and I think I know the answer, but anyway, so does this issue of Breakdowns deserve the bad reputation, or is it better than most folks remember?
I think I've worn my heart on my sleeve on this one, Shay. I think Breakdowns is a terrific piece of storytelling. I think it's an absolute tribute to the entire run of Giffen and DeMatteis on this book. And I was astounded that anybody could think negative thoughts about it. But I guess, you know, I will hold my hand up and go, this is through complete nostalgia goggles. It just hit me at my absolute right point in my comics journey. So, for me personally, it's a win through and through, and I won't hear a word said against it.
I'm right there with you. Now, again, I don't have the nostalgia issue because, again, I haven't read it in 30 years and have no memory of it, really, other than what's on the covers. So for me, this is great. This was a great adventure comic. It affected me emotionally. It got reactions out of me. I love the art. This issue is an absolute win. So awesome. Yeah. All right, Chris, now is that important critical moment where we have to debate the
One Punch Award.
This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's fantastic or shocking or dramatic, funny, awe-inspiring, whatever. Both myself and Chris will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted One Punch Award. Chris, what's your nomination?
It's page 19. It's all those reaction shots. It's beautiful. It's emotional. It's an absolute sock in the gut. It probably made me a comics fan for these last 35 years. It's a 1-2 punch for me.
Yeah. No, I don't think there was any doubt what it was going to be in this issue, right? I will add page 18 and 19 together.
Yeah.
Just the accidental, you know, workplace accident. I mean, that's kind of what this is, right? Yeah. It's a workplace accident. A pretty horrible one. But either way, it's 18, what happens there leading to the reactions in 19. Absolutely. So, yeah. So congratulations to the getting the hole blown in your head, Little Mermaid, and everyone's reaction to that. Just doesn't come out right. You're the winner of the One Punch Award. Please wear it with pride, maybe on your shirt, not on your... Anyway, yeah. It's as tangible as our love for that moment. Now, Chris, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit while I go do feedback? I think someone needs to clean up around the Global Guardians conference room a bit. You're probably going to need a mop and probably a lot of paper towels.
Yeah, I think there's brain in the chandelier. I'm going to get a ladder.
Oh, okay. Well, we all appreciate you doing this for us, sir. And don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And folks, while Chris is taking care of that, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Log.
All right, and before we get into your feedback, just a quick plug. If you enjoy fun comics like JLI, you might be a fan also of the Blue Devil comic from the early 1980s. And if so, I am covering those comics over on my Once Upon a Geek podcast. We just released an episode discussing the 16-page preview from Fury of Firestorm. We've got an interview with creators coming up, and we'll be covering Blue Devil number 1 in the near future. And from there, we'll be hitting other issues of the series sporadically. So you might want to check that out over at Once Upon a Geek. Now, folks, regarding Justice League International, please get out on the social media. As I always say, it's about building a community of JLI fans around the show. And remember, when you're posting your comments, please let me know if you're outside of the United States, and we will assign you the appropriate embassy. Now, right now, we're going to hit your comments specifically about the last episode, which was part of the JL May crossover covering Brave and the Bold. We covered issue 23 featuring Booster Gold and Magog. But my guest on that episode was the fantastic John Koos. So here we go. I'm covering your feedback from our website, email, social media, things like that. And I'm just pulling bits and pieces because there is a lot of feedback as always. So first off, we have Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary and Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange quotes me saying, "Congratulations, dismembered arm." And he says, "Words I never thought I would hear in that order." He goes on to say, "Great discussion. I'm not a big Booster Gold fan, but it sounds like this is an issue that showcases why I should be." Oh, Dr. Ange, there's a great history there between Booster and Superman. Admittedly not Supergirl, but the cousin of Supergirl. So maybe there's something you'll find enjoy there. They are from Tim Price from the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. And by the way, on the day of this recording, I believe I'll be hanging out with Tim Price at Heroes Con. So awesome. So Tim says, "As another booster, I co-signed Shag's statement that he's the most successful post-crisis creation. Which first, makes my tummy hurt for agreeing with Shag. And second, Booster Gold number 1 was published between issue number 11 and 12 of Crisis on Infinite Earths, making decidedly the first series starting in post-crisis continuity, but still came out before Crisis was finished." And then Tim says, "Now my head hurts too." Tim writes a lot more, but then he notes, "Huh, I haven't written anything about Magog. Huh." Yeah, I completely understand, Tim, and I think most people's responses were pretty much in that ballpark. Tim goes on to give John Koos some compliments, and he says, "Thank you both for another fun podcast." Well, thank you, Tim. We appreciate it. They heard from Captain Entropy, who I also will be hanging out at Heroes Con with the day this comes out. He says, "Shag and John, great coverage of an issue that has great art and at least one, possibly two great characters. I'm on the fence about Rip Hunter. I was following this era's Booster Gold series right before a move separated me from my family for a while and turned life upside down. I remember enjoying the ones I read, especially issue number 5 and 1 million. That 1 million issue can still get me emotional because I felt that way about some people the way Batman felt about Booster. Quote, 'From now on, I don't care what anyone says. I've seen who you really are, and I am on your side.'" Oh, well, thank you for sharing, Captain Entropy. They heard from someone named Tim Levine. I'm not really sure who this guy is. But he says, "Mark Waid did do a Gog New Year's Evil one-shot in 1998. And more recently, there's a Magog connection in an arc on Mark Waid's excellent World's Finest story." And then he says, "To say any more would be spoilery." We received similar comments from Joe Tonello from the Get Bit podcast and Chris Lister, both mentioning World's Finest and all of them kind of agreeing that it's awesome. Now, guys, I've read the first couple issues of World's Finest and I loved it. So, yeah, I got to get back to that. And I guess I get to see Magog again. They were from Rob McCarthy from the Hell on Wheels webcomic. You may recall we posted some questions about Gog and Magog and just the origins of the names. So Rob shares that Gog and Magog are both from the Book of Revelations that lead a war on the Christian nations. In Kingdom Come, he leads the new heroes versus the old. It's not subtle. He's wearing a Devil, Loki, Magneto helmet. In Kingdom Come, he's just a counterpoint to Superman, blows up Kansas, weeps, and gives up. He's just there to make a point. I'm not a fan of Kingdom Come at all. All right, well, thank you, Rob. And then similarly, we heard from Gene Hendricks, executive director at Azir Voices and part of the Two True Freaks podcast network. Gene says, regarding the goat helmet that Magog wears, outside the comic universe explanation is that he's literally the false idol from the Book of Exodus. He is the golden calf that the Jews, the public, create to worship while waiting for Moses, Superman, to return from Mount Sinai, Fortress of Solitude. All right. Well, thank you, Rob and Gene. Thank you for all that feedback. Then we heard from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Jason says, "Count me in as another huge Booster fan. I first read about him in JLI, but found most of his 80s series at a flea market in the early 1990s and loved it. Those first 12 issues are great, and I still have them. Count me in as another person who thinks Magog is a tool and didn't see the point of bringing him into the main DCU. But at this point, JSA were doing lots of Alex Ross covers and bringing in other Kingdom Come characters in costumes like Starman, Sandman, Tomcat, Cyclone. Even Kingdom Come Superman was on the team for a while." Then he says the JSA also went nuts with legacy characters, and something you guys did not mention is that Magog started out as a legacy character of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's right. The JSA recruited him because he was a descendant of FDR who happened to have an alien laser gun thing grafted on his arm and was a Marine Lance Corporal who joined the JSA under the codename Lance. He's around like that for a while before he meets Gog and gets transformed. But yeah, the FDR connection is what got him onto the team. Bizarre. Wow. Jason, you just blew my mind because I read those comics and I literally have no memory of any of that. Well, thank you. Then we heard from Herb Fung from our Canadian embassy, somewhere in the Canadian Rockies to be specific. Herb says, wow, I don't remember the story at all. I guess I must have missed it. It's almost surprising because I'm a big Booster fan from the beginning. The promo material and the house ads, I think I first saw him in that two-color Direct Currents. I still have the promo button that was given away for the book's launch. I even had my name mentioned in the letter column at some point. Wow, that's awesome, Herb. Then he says, but getting back to the story, as gory as the scene where the hostage taker has his arm ripped off, I'm surprised Booster didn't have a stronger reaction. After all, he personally knows what it's like to have his own arm ripped off by the Overmaster during the Judgment Day event. Whoa! Once again, Herb, another thing I had completely forgotten about. Wow, okay. They were from Symbol Pending from our England embassy. They, of course, run the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. They said, not sure I can add much to the Magog debate. As said, he's a pastiche of 90s superheroes that somehow, because the type of hero he was taking the mickey of. At least you were going to take a character from Kingdom Come. It has to be Power Woman, right? All right. Well, thank you, Symbol Pending. Appreciate that. Then we heard from Devin Clancy, who says, I bought Booster Gold number one not just because it was number one, because they gave me a free pin. I wore that on my jean jacket for the rest of the 80s. Awesome, Devin. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, not sure if ripping the guy's arm off would work. With the dead man switch activated, with the cord being broke, count as letting go of the switch and boom? Since the connection of the bomb's disconnected, the hand is still on the switch, but the cord is broken. That is an interesting thought, Liz. Hadn't thought of that. And then Liz comments on our discussion where we said Booster Gold was the most popular character to come out post-Crisis. Liz says, hold up. Booster's great, but I think he's not the only hero created after Crisis. Well, created in Crisis, but John Constantine kind of counts. Not really as a hero, but he's close enough, and he's done well enough. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Liz. I mean, he's had his own movie, he's had his own TV show, The Legends of Tomorrow. So yeah, that is a good call. I did not think about that, and that would be an interesting question to pose out there. Who do you think is more popular amongst the, you know, the general audience, the muggles, if you will, folks? Do you think Constantine or Booster Gold has more name recognition? And, you know, I'm afraid it might be Constantine. Huh. All right. Something to think about, Liz. Thank you. They are from Mike Dynas from our Pacific Canadian Embassy. Mike says, well done, gentlemen. While the issue has not been spectacular, you guys certainly were. I think I missed getting this issue on purpose when it came out, as I think it was the same mind as Shag. Magog worked for Kingdom Come, but there was no reason to bring him back for any reason. He was a product of the story who didn't merit any kind of backstory or continuing adventures. I think if you wanted a more grim and dark hero to team up with Booster, it would have been great to see Lobo. He has connections to the early GLI stories, and he also has that humor that I feel sets him apart from other anti-heroes. Having said my piece on that, I just want to say you guys made this issue enjoyable by hearing your reactions and opinions on the issue. Also, John's dulcet tones are music to my ears. Oh, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Then over from Bucky749 for the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel as well. He says, I'm not a huge Booster Gold fan, but I have a DC showcase of his comics. I'll have to reread it. Hey, Bucky, that DC showcase that reprints all those early Booster Gold issues is fantastic. You should dig in if you like 80s comics. Then we heard from Jimmy McGlinchey from the Irish Embassy. Jimmy says, Magog is an interesting character. I remember his introduction in John's post-52 Justice Society and his move into the JSA All-Stars. I think he works better as part of a team, sort of a roided-up Guy Gardner type, rather than a lead of his own series. I glanced at his 12-issue series recently, and I can't remember thinking much of it, except for crossing over into Justice Society and JSA All-Stars a few times. Magog was obviously considered to be a big deal through by DC, as they had Giffen writing it with Howard Porter providing the art, and they got Scott Collins to finish the series. All good creators. I'm surprised that no one mentioned that Magog's demise has a JLI association. It happened in the Brightest Day era in the series called Justice League Generation Lost. They resurrected Maxwell Lord and had him put a mind whammy on Magog to take out the Generation Lost League, but after a fight with Captain Atom, Atom managed to get Magog to remember who Max was. However, Max then turned up to blow up Magog, which achieved two things. Number one, his mind control made people think that Captain Atom killed Magog, thus further damaging the League's team. And number two, fulfilling the White Ring's request to, quote, stop the war, which means stopping the future of Kingdom Come happening. The White Ring had issued a number of requests to all the other resurrected heroes from Blackest Night. Interesting, Jimmy. You know, again, this is what, the third or fourth time I've had to say in this episode that, again, something I've read and have absolutely no recollection of. I did read Generation Lost. I think it started strong. I was not a big fan by the end, and I don't remember any of that stuff with Magog. So, wow. Thank you, Jimmy. I appreciate you enlightening us. Then from Martin Gray from our Scottish Embassy, and he has the Two Dangers for Girl blog, Martin says, that was a good discussion of an issue of Brave and the Bold. Very fair. I find it really weird that DC was pushing Magog so hard. He wasn't popular with readers so far as I could see. May as well have called him Captain Fetch. Oh, Martin, stop trying to make Fetch happen. Then we heard from Edwin Billet, and Edwin, I am sure I mispronounced your last name. I am so sorry there. But Edwin says, hey, Shag, it's Nort's swimsuit in the DC universe because in our world, it's sports rhymes with Nort, illustrated swimsuit issue. Enjoy the meanwhile and look forward to continuing on with the next chapters of Breakdowns. Oh, well, I hope this episode did not disappoint Edwin. And thank you for enlightening me on Nort's and sports. I did not see the connection. I was not going to make that myself. So much appreciated. They are from Chris Pine, who says, I am happy to find out that everyone else here hates Magog. Hopefully he is Magong forever, because he was Magawful. Magog away, you Magoof. Oh my gosh, Chris. Oh, wow. Chris goes on to say, I wonder if Jurgens was being a little subversive in this issue, because I found Magog leaning into every terrible 90s extreme stereotype so hard that it almost felt like it was on purpose. Juxtaposing this trope that was so popular in comics and now feels so dated and tired. Against his own creation, Booster Gold, who may have seemed old-fashioned in the 90s, but has had the staying power beyond characters like Magog, just feels like some kind of statement by Jurgens that I haven't fully fleshed out yet to articulate any better than this. You know, Chris, it's quite possible. There may be something embedded in there that Dan's trying to say about that extreme 90s period. Yeah, could very well be. Then we're from Doug Adamson from our Scottish Embassy. Doug says, the best part of this episode was that for over half the time, John Coos did his very, very best not to talk about the issue at hand. That's true. We had a lot of other things we felt like were more interesting to cover. Then Doug says, both John and Shag managed to make this issue sound fun. Yeah, I said sound fun, because honestly, I can't recall a time I look forward to reading anything with Magog in it. Totally understand that, Doug. They were from Brett Young from Imagine 8 Design. Brett says, maybe I'm the bad guy here, but I'm okay with Goatman tearing his arm off that if that was the only way in the moment to save those kids. Plus, that terrorist seemed to take it pretty well. He's even standing up in one of the last panels, so I guess no crying over torn arms. Book him! Then he says, not a doily in sight, I'm afraid, but there's some nice checkerboard flooring with arm blood all over it. Glad you pointed that out, Brett. Thank you so much. And I hope you were listening closely to today's synopsis, because I did slip a doily reference in just for you. Then we heard from Crazy Joe Adventures. He picked up several custom Lego minifigs of various JLI characters, and it looks great. All right, folks, now I do want to say thank you to everyone who helped promote the JL May 2023 crossover. So thank you all of you who participated in the crossover. Thank you for all of those of you that shared it or tweeted it, retweeted, shared, whatever you may have done to help get the word out there about JL May. All right, now we're going to take a second to thank all the folks who shared the JLI podcast on their social media timeline, whether it be Facebook or Twitter. Now, I do want to say that this month, Twitter is acting up a little bit for me. So I had some difficulty tracking down tweets. I hope I got all of them. If I did not, please, you know exactly where you can send your blue checkmark complaints, and I apologize in advance. So folks, here we go. Thank you to everyone who promoted the last episode by sharing on Facebook or retweeting on Twitter. So our thanks to Andre TFG, Billy Delicious, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook Group, Chris Franklin, Chris Lydon, Coffee and Comics, Diablo Frank, Digest Cast, Doc RX, Doug Adamson, Dr. Jennifer Sports Levine, Ed Moore, Jason R. Lady, Jeff Poyer, Joe Tonello, John Coos, Justin Steiner, Keith G. Baker, Con L., Laurel Mountainflower 1, Lizanne Oswald, Longbox Review, Martin Kogan, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mike Dinas, Mo Walker, Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Paul Kean, Pragmatic Gollum, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Rob Kelly, Siskoid, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Symbol Pending, The Bat Pod, The Daily Rios, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Warlord Thanos Podcast, and Zek Cap Boots. Oh, well, thank you again to all of you for your support of the JLI Podcast. As I always say, your feedback is such an important part of the show, and the community of JLI fans we have built together is absolutely fantastic. You guys are the best. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I'm terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of John Coos or Twitter being obnoxious. Let me know, and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. Hit up our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Please leave your comments on the show post. That is where most of the activity is going on there. Or you can find us on Facebook as JLI Podcast, or on Twitter at JLI Podcast, or email at JLIPodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to John Coos for appearing on the most recent episode of the show, and thank you, listeners, for such a fantastic, excellent, amazing, spectacular web of collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if we can bring our guests from this episode, Tim Levine and Chris Lewis, together in the same embassy. Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. All right, folks, we are back from break. And yes, it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought both Tim and Chris together for us. Okay, Tim, so I got to say, I think you presented yourself quite well. I mean, you went into this with a lot of pressure on you. You know, you had to hold up your end of the deal with what your wife has done on so many episodes where she's been absolutely fantastic. And I got to say, you didn't suck too much.
I appreciate that, Shag. I'm still kind of getting over having to fix that teleporter, but I had to take the thing apart, man. There was Nort-colored fur inside of the thing.
That tracks. That actually tracks. Yeah, I could see that.
He was apparently using the heatsink as some kind of paw warmer.
Well, he did spend a lot of time in Antarctica, you know, so...
Yeah, but get yourself a furry space heater or something.
Oh, gosh. Well, Tim, thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Where can folks find more of you?
Well, that's... Let me give you a reference here. Do you remember there was a comic in the late 90s that was called Superboy and Robin, World's Finest Three, or WF3,
oh, yeah,
or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that there was a line in the first issue where Superboy says to Robin, you know, I got a pretty good rep. Most people know who Superboy is. How come most people don't know who Robin is? And Robin says to him, that's by design.
Okay.
It's in all seriousness, because I've been doing IT stuff for 20 plus years, I never really embraced the social media stuff. Kind of, it was all kind of BS internet to me. To you know, I was writing web pages back in the day. I don't really have much of an active social media presence or footprint. People can email me if they want. My email is hosstbl1@yahoo.com. I also like to hang out on the collectededition.com forums that are listed under Tapatalk, or I don't even know how you say that. I think it's tapatalk.com, collected edition forums. It's formerly the Marvel Masterworks board, but they expanded to a bunch of other things. And I usually hang out among the DC boards there. I like to think of that place as the place that the grownups go to talk about comics. You know, it's not like it's not like the Newsarama forums back in the day.
Oh.
very, very different than that. So I, you know, I post under HostTBL, or maybe it's HostTBL1, but, you know, I'm sure you'll run into me if you hang out there, and I'd recommend people go there, because there is a lot more grown-up discussion there than a lot of the message boards you find around places.
Well, it certainly sounds like someplace I should not be allowed to frequent then, if people are being mature about things. So, excellent. Well, Tim, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And it's been, and genuinely, it's been a blast chatting with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Shag. It's been a fun time.
Now, Chris, thank you so much for coming back to the embassy. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. It's always a pleasure, sir. Would you please tell the people at home where they can find more of you?
Well, I'm coming back to do some more podcasts on here, actually. Rob and I are going to do some mashes, and we have some films we want to do. So probably there. And obviously November is a big date for all of us Doctor Who fans. So very much appreciating talking to you in November about Doctor Who. You don't know that, Shag. I've just invited myself.
I will check my schedule and maybe we'll see. I don't know. I like how Chris has nominated himself as the scheduler for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. That's interesting.
No, I think the schedule is too difficult for me to handle. It sounds complicated.
It does involve using an abacus and taking your shoes off to count. So either way, Chris, okay. Thank you so much for being here again. It's been a real pleasure. And folks, that's going to do it. Now come back next episode when we cover Justice League America number 55 and Justice League Europe number 31. And we'll have two more guest hosts to help me cover the issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Chris.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?